You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 25th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Nicaragua has been very much in the news lately. Many of you will remember, some I suspect with fond memories, the Sandinista revolution in that country 40 years ago and the U.S. efforts under President Reagan to violently overturn it. It was an issue that engaged a sufficient number of the American public that a nationwide phone campaign by U.S. supporters of the Sandinistas was able to bring about a congressional resolution cutting off U.S. funds to the administration-backed Contras, something that is difficult to imagine happening today. Consequently, the reports of ongoing street protests across the Nicaraguan countryside and the widespread demands for the resignation of President Daniel Ortega in the wake of his government's brutal response to the protests has been both troubling and confusing for those still having some emotional stake in the Nicaraguan revolution. Along with the situation in Syria and Venezuela, the issue has caused serious divisions in what was once considered the left here in the United States. Some old-timers who were once active in supporting the Sandinistas view all the troubles there as the latest attempt by Washington to establish a puppet government in Managua. Others see the situation as one in which the Sandino legacy has long been abandoned and the Nicaraguan people are simply responding to the increasingly dictatorial powers of President Ortega and his wife Rosario Murillo, who happens to be the country's vice president and a powerful figure in her own right. Rebecca Gordon, who teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco and lived for a time in Nicaragua, is one of the latter. I'll be speaking with her about the situation there in her recent article for Times Dispatch entitled Nicaragua at the Barricades and a Crossroads at 20 minutes past the hour, so please stay tuned for that. The current issue of Time magazine features a remarkable computer-generated portrait that combines the faces of President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, and as one has come to expect, a feature article on the inside offering a further analysis of the summit meeting between the two men last week in Helsinki. As with what appears to be every other mainstream media outlet these days, the criticism of Russia as a military aggressor, as an existential threat, and our democracy has been relentless. Not an hour can go by without an NPR host interviewing a former U.S. diplomat or general about the danger from Russia, and while there are centers out there who are not paid Russian propagandists in the current atmosphere, you will neither read nor hear what they have to say. One might argue that the gerrymandering of congressional districts, the arbitrary purging by Republican state officials of thousands of black and brown voters from the voting rolls going back to the 2000 elections, where it made the difference in Florida and put Bush in the White House, you remember that, their ongoing efforts to make it more difficult for the elderly and poor to even register to vote, and the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that removed all limits to corporate campaign financing have done more to undermine what was left of our democracy than any Russian, President Putin, or group of Russians huddling behind their computers could hope to do. To understand Trump's actions is another story. I am not one to credit him with doing anything that doesn't primarily benefit himself. The notion that Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un and Putin reflects his concern for world peace and harmony among nations is simply non-credible and lead me to the conclusion, shared by others, that Trump had a number of dealings with Russian businessmen and financiers who are close to Putin and to whom he owns a debt. There is, however, a separate issue from what we – this is, however, a separate issue from what we're told to believe without being shown the evidence that Russia's so-called meddling was responsible for putting Trump in the White House. There was another election meddling which led to a Time magazine cover which strangely has been absent from the current discussion, which I mentioned on an earlier program. It was from July 1996 and had the face of a smiling Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, on the cover, with an American flag pinned on his label, on his lapel, and with good reason, as accompanying headline promised, "The Secret Behind Yeltsin Win." On opening the magazine, the reader found a story by Martin Kramer, Time's Moscow correspondent, headlined "Rescuing Boris, the Secret Story of How Four U.S. Advisors Used Polls, Focus Groups, Negative Ads, and All the Other Techniques of American Campaigning to Help Boris Yeltsin Win." It described how American Republican political operatives who had previously worked for California Governor Pete Wilson had gone to Russia to rescue his bid for re-election when polls indicated the Communist Party might return to power. The outcome was by no means inevitable, wrote Kramer. The past winter, Yeltsin's approval ratings were in the single digit. There are many reasons for his change in fortune, but a crucial one has remained a secret. For 4 months, a group of American political consultants clandestinely participated in guiding Yeltsin's campaign. Yeltsin's standing in the polls, wrote Kramer, was a reflection of his brutal misadventure in Chechnya, his increasing authoritarianism, and his economic reform program, which has brought about corruption and widespread suffering, end quote. Considering the country's deep dislike of Yeltsin and the communist surge in election in the Russian Duma in December 1995, Felix Brainin, a close friend of some of Yeltsin's top aides who immigrated to San Francisco, thought that something radical had to be done. According to Kramer's report, he began a series of confidential discussions with Yeltsin's first deputy prime minister, Oleg Soskovets, who was in charge of his re-election effort. In early February 1996, Brainin was instructed to, quote, find some Americans, but to proceed discreetly. Security and secrecy was paramount, said Brainin. Everyone realized that if the communists knew about this before the election, they would attack Yeltsin as an American tool. We barely needed the team, but having them was a big risk, end quote. Well, they turned out to be veterans of Pete Wilson's election campaign. They enlisted Richard Dresner, a New York-based consultant who had worked with them on many of Wilson's campaigns. Dresner had another connection that would prove useful later on, wrote Kramer. In the late 70s and early 80s, he had joined with Dick Morris to help Bill Clinton get elected in Arkansas as governor. As Clinton's current political guru at the time, Morris became the middleman on those few occasions when the Americans sought the administration's help in Yeltsin's reelection drive. So while Clinton was uninvolved personally with Yeltsin's recruitment of the American advisors, the administration knew of their existence. In late February, Dresner was in Moscow meeting Soskovets. "There's not much time," he said. "You're hired," Soskovets told Dresner. "I will tell the president that we have the Americans," end quote. And then Time magazine's Martin Kramer wrote, Soskovets ominously added a thought that would reverberate in early May. Alluding to Yeltsin's poor standing and the reluctance of his aides ever to yield power to the communists, Soskovets told Dresner, "One of your tasks is to advise us a month from the election about whether we should call it off if you determine that we're going to lose," end quote. To preserve security, a contract was drawn between the International Industrial Bancorp Incorporated of San Francisco, a company Felix Brainin managed for its Moscow parent, and Dresner Wickers, Dresner's consulting firm in Bedford Hills, New York. The Americans would work for 4 months beginning March 1st. They'd be paid $250,000 plus all expenses and have an unlimited budget for polling, focus groups, and other research. A week later, they were working full-time. When they started, Yeltsin's approval rating was about 6%, and Joseph Stalin had a higher positive rating in the polls. Yet Yeltsin defeated communist candidate Gennady Zyukhanov by more than 13 percentage points. One unfortunate result of that victory was the turning over to a handful of wealthy businessmen, now referred to as the oligarchs, the control of Russia's natural resources through a plan to finance, as Yeltsin's campaign described as, quote, loans for shares. The loans were to Yeltsin, and when he couldn't pay them back, he held a private closed auction with his creditors, which resulted in what was arguably the greatest theft ever of the country's resources and a dozen new Russian billionaires. And it wouldn't have happened without American meddling. A month ago, you heard Robert Fisk of the Independent of London, long based in Beirut, discussing his visit to Syria to investigate reports that the Syrian government had used sarin gas on the residents of the town of Douma, which Fisk found no witnesses or evidence to support the claim. Earlier, he had traveled to Aleppo after the bombing by Russian and Syrian aircraft had reduced much of the eastern part of that city to rubble. In the July 20th issue of The Independent, he wrote that in the basement of a bombed-out al-Qaeda arms storage building in eastern Aleppo last year, he found a weapons logbook from a mortar factory in Bosnia with a handwritten name of one of its senior officials, Efet Kernjic, on each page. On the first page was a note indicating that a cargo of 500 to 120 millimeter mortars had been shipped January 2016 from the Balkans, so Fisk went searching for Ifrit Krnjic in the heart of central Bosnia, and he found him. According to Krnjic, his company sent the arms to Saudi Arabia. When Fisk showed him the logbook, Krnjic was quick to acknowledge that it was his signature on every page, and that Saudi officials and military personnel had come to the factory to inspect the mortars before their shipment to Riyadh, and that all such sales were strictly in accordance with the legal end-user certificates which his company obtained from all customers. These state that the weapons were to be used only by the armed forces of the nations which purchased them. 500 mortars is a massive amount of shipments. Most European armies don't have that many in their individual inventories, writes Fisk, and some of them at least appear to have ended up in the hands of Bashar al-Assad's Islamic Nusra Front al-Qaeda enemies in northern Syria within 6 months of their dispatch from Bosnia, 1,200 miles away. According to Fisk, the documents indicate the mortars must have reached Aleppo by late July 2016, when Syrian troops totally surrounded the enclave held by armed factions, including Nusra, ISIS, and other Islamic groups condemned as terrorists by the United States. Fisk recalls that in the last stages of the 2016 siege of Aleppo, Syrian and Russian forces were condemned in the West for the daily bombings of civilian areas of eastern Aleppo, and video footage provided constant images of dead and wounded men, women, and children. During this period, however, he writes, the city's Islamist defenders, most of whom later departed under a promise of safe passage for jihadi-held areas of Idlib province, fired barrages of mortar shells, at government-held western Aleppo. If that was announced at all by the U.S. press, it was at the very end of the story. In another badly damaged building, lying half-concealed amid iron fragments and field dressings, Fisk found piles of discarded documents containing firing instructions for machine guns and mortars, all of them in English. In yet another building with the words Jaish al-Mujahideen, which means Army of the Holy Fighters, crudely painted but still visible on the front, he found dozens of empty boxes for anti-armor weapons, all marked with their maker's name, the Hughes Aircraft Company of California. The boxes were labeled, quote, guided missile surface attack, unquote, with stock numbers and the computer code clearly visible. You can find Robert Fisk's entire article on the Independence webpage. Israel has been an apartheid state since its inception. From its founding in 1948 to 1966, the 150,000 Palestinians remained after 750,000 had been ethnically cleansed were kept segregated in the Galilee under military control, and even when that was lifted, 97% of the country was restricted to Jews only. Since 1967, when Israel launched its war against Egypt and occupied the West Bank and Gaza, it has effectively controlled all the land and the air above it, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, with the Palestinians barred from living in Jewish settlements, barred from driving on far superior Jewish-only roads, and subjected to scores of checkpoints. As far as back as the 1980s, South Africans as well as a number of Israeli journalists were calling it apartheid, although the best U.S. officials could do was warn Israel that if it did not make an accommodation for a Palestinian mini-state or Bantustan, it would inevitably become an apartheid state, as if it wasn't that already. The notion of creating a single democratic state with one person, one vote, was, of course, out of the question. The world was told, would place the Jewish character of the state in jeopardy. Well, the character of the state became evident early Thursday morning when the Knesset, Israel's legislative body, passed by a 62-55 vote a piece of legislation making Israel the, quote, nation state of the Jewish people, unquote. The so-called nationality law enshrines in Israel's quasi-constitutional basic law that Israel is a nation state of the Jewish people. Much of the bill sponsored by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party deals with obvious signs that Israel is a Jewish state, such as affirming the symbols on the flag and shield, seeing a Hebrew calendar as the country's official calendar, recognizing Jewish holidays of days of remembrance, the national anthem, and naming Jerusalem as the capital, and also, of course, making Hebrew the official language. Netanyahu called the passing of the law a defining moment. What he said was, we enshrine in law the basic principle of our existence. Israel is a nation state of the Jewish people that respects the individual rights of all its citizens. This is our state, the Jewish state. In recent years, there have been some who have attempted to undermine this, to undercut our very existence. Today, we made it a law. This is our nation, language, anthem, and flag, end quote. The chairman of the Arab Journalist Party, Ayman Odeh, said in a statement that Israel, quote, has declared it does not want us here, end quote, meaning its Arab citizens, and that, quote, we will always be second-class citizens, end quote. They represent one-fifth of the Israeli population, approximately 1.5 million, and are descendants of those who remained in 1948. And despite Israeli propaganda, they are treated as equals with all the same opportunities as Israeli Jews. It has never been true. Now the inequality is enshrined in Israeli law, and it could get about its business of telling the world what to do. Well, let's start in Syria, where the day before one of its U.S. Patriot missiles shot down a Russian-made Syrian jet over the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Netanyahu rejected the Russian proposal to help keep Iranian forces in Syria 100 kilometers or 62 miles from Israel's northern border, which it considers to be at the edge of the Golan Heights. That no country, including the U.S., up to this point recognizes the Golan as part of Israel has never meant anything, since its domestic lobbies in the U.S., as in the U.K., France, and Germany, hold their respective governments in thrall. Israel is also sticking to its demand of Moscow that Iran not be allowed any military foothold in Syria, that all long-range missiles be removed from the country, and that any factories producing precision-guided missiles there be closed. Additionally, Israel wants Moscow to guarantee that all air defense systems that protect the aforementioned arms will be removed from Syria. And lastly, Israel wants the border crossings between Syria and Lebanon and between Syria and Iraq closed to prevent Iranian weapons smuggling. This set of demands, which tramples on the sovereignty of three neighboring states, will put up the now tight relationship between Putin and Netanyahu to its stiffest test. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week, we continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference, held in Cambridge on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square. Today, we feature the presentations from the first panel, titled Balfour, Israel, and Palestine. The first speech is by Professor Lawrence Davidson of Westchester University, speaking on Balfour and the Zionist Project. He is immediately followed by Professor Susan Ockram of Boston University Law School, speaking on Balfour and international law. She is followed by Thomas Suarez, author of State of Terror, How Terrorism Created Modern Israel, speaking on the role of terror in the state-building process. The panel was facilitated by Hilary Rintisi of the Middle East Project at Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming at this early hour on a weekend, and a cold weekend for that. So I really appreciate your presence here. I want to thank the organizers as well, and especially Nancy Murray and Elaine Hagopian for their hard work, their vision, and their leadership in our community here. I'm honored to chair this panel of distinguished speakers at this very important conference. As we reflect on the consequences of the Balfour Declaration, we must recognize that the racist, colonial, and arrogant mindset that brought it about 100 years ago and allowed for the establishment of a settler colonial state on the land of Palestine dispossessed many Palestinians, including my entire family, and violently uprooted and placed them in a purgatory for the rest of their lives, whereby they were stateless, landless, and repeatedly had their history and culture erased. This same mindset continues today, as do the countless injustices suffered by the Palestinians. This is why this conference is important. This is not just a history of what happened 100 years ago, but the consequences that continue to this day. And I look forward to hearing all the various presentations we will be hearing today from different perspectives. With my brief remarks here, I will start with very brief introductions, as the bios are in the programs you have. But since this is the first panel of the conference, I ask that you help me to keep this on track and so that we can hear everyone and have time for discussion. First, we have Lawrence Davidson, a professor emeritus of history at Westchester University, speaking, followed by Susan Akram, professor of international law at Boston University and director of International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University, and finally, Tom Suarez, faculty member of Palestine's National Conservatory of Music and author of several books, and he will also be signing his book over the lunch break. So please join me in welcoming our guest panelists for this morning. Professor Davidson, if you could join me upstairs.
The title of my brief talk is Balfour and the Zionist Project. I want to begin with a series of statements. Let's imagine that Balfour is here, and we'll make a series of statements to him, and what these statements will do is affirm without hesitation that he agrees to what we're saying. Okay? So the first statement is that Britain in 1917 is an imperialist empire, and if she and her allies win in the First World War, that Britain would quickly expand its empire, particularly in the Middle East. Balfour would agree with this statement without hesitation. Second, if we asserted that the Arab and other indigenous peoples of the Middle East were less civilized and less politically capable than Europeans, who at the time were bent on slaughtering each other, but that's an aside, Balfour would agree with this, and he would say that because the non-European peoples of the Middle East were less capable, that they were they could rightly be put under European imperial or colonial sway. Third, if we then suggested, perhaps lowering our voice a bit here, that the wealthier elements of European Jewry exercised worldwide financial and political influence that could be used to help Britain and her allies win the war, Balfour would agree with that too. And of course, it would be based on that belief that he would make his declarative promise to support the creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine in return for Jewish wartime assistance. Then, perhaps after a solemn silence, we asserted to Balfour that the Old Testament Bible certainly held literal truths, among them the prophecy that the Jewish people would be one day returned to their promised land of Israel. Balfour would again agree with this without hesitation. And in this regard, Balfour, as well as Prime Minister Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of England at the time, would see themselves as playing a role in the fulfillment of biblical prophecy by assisting the return of the Jewish people to the modern site of ancient Israel, which was Palestine. And it should be noticed that Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States at the time, would see himself in the same light. So we have three men of particular importance and national leadership, Prime Minister of England, the Foreign Minister of England, and the President of the United States, all who believed in biblical prophecy and saw themselves as playing a role in it. So against Balfour's dedication to the expansion of empire, his illusionary assumption of Jewish world influence, and his religious faith in the Old Testament prophecies, the fate of the Palestinian Arabs weighed very little. In fact, on August 11, 1919, Balfour wrote a memo to the Foreign Office, and in it he said, quote, "Zionism is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs and future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabited that ancient land," unquote. And just also as an aside, it's ironic, there were only two members of the war cabinet, the British war cabinet, who raised any objections to the Balfour Declaration based on consideration of the native population, of the Arab population in Palestine, which were then referred to as Muslimmen. Ironically, one of those was Jan Smuts of South Africa, and the other was the Jewish Lord Edwin Montague. Okay. Now, moving on, let's make a series of statements that Chaim Weizmann, who Balfour is working with at this time, and other leaders of the World Zionist Organization would agree to without hesitation. Okay? And these will be familiar, but they set up the scenario for my conclusions. One is that a Jewish state is the only plausible answer to the problem of European anti-Semitism. And since European Jews were the victim of this anti-Semitism, whatever state would be created would have to be populated and controlled by European Jews. This was the so-called Zionist project. And Chaim Weizmann, you know, it was a complete agreement, obviously, and he was at the forefront of trying to create this and bring this project to fruition. Now, it is to be noted that the political Zionists, like Weizmann, gave almost no thought. In fact, I could find no actual reference in the documents at all to Sephardic Jews of the Near East or the significance of centuries of relative peaceful coexistence between Sephardic Jews and the Arabs. They were simply not referenced. Okay? The second statement would be that Jews of Zionist persuasion were, by 1917, agreed that Palestine, the site of ancient Israel, was the only acceptable site for such a state. And thirdly, the non-Jewish population in Palestine, native population, was of no more consequence to Zionist Jews than they were to the imperially minded British. The reason for that is because these Jews were, despite anti-Semitism, of a European mindset, and thus partook of the essentially racist view of non-Europeans at the time. In this regard, on January 19th, 1943, in a meeting with the Near East Department, subdepartment of the State Department, Chaim Weizmann stated categorically that, quote, Palestine can never be an Arab land again. And finally, Weizmann would agree with the statement that in the attempt to found a Jewish state in Palestine, an alliance with an expansionist imperial state was a reasonable tactical step. And Great Britain, rather than Germany, was the logical partner. This is because Germany was allied to the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire was, before the British came in control of Palestine. So it's to be noted that these statements, to which Balfour and Weizmann both would agree, reflected unquestioned assumptions, which in turn supported the main traits of imperialism as practiced before World War II. And these were, briefly, a sense of superiority of European civilization, a sense of possessing a superior religion, Christianity or Judaism, a racist attitude towards non-Europeans, and a willingness to ignore the rights of alleged inferiors. Now, today, most of us, particularly here, but most of us, understand that these assumptions are both factually and morally indefensible, and their consequences should be addressed and remedied. But Balfour and Weizmann were living in a time where that particular modern attitude made no sense to them at all. Nonetheless, to the extent that modern people share now this sense of moral repulsion, the world has really changed. And today we can say we live in a post-colonial era wherein imperialism is thought of as a negative thing of the past. This means that both the Balfour Declaration and the Zionist Project are really anachronisms, things of the past, much like white South Africa was. They are all products of a pre-World War II colonial era. And this leads us to another really seminal consequence. For Israel today to be truly accepted into the modern world, one of two things must happen. Either Israel must give up its racist ideology of Zionism, or the world must revert back to an acceptance of at least some of the colonial practices of the 19th century. Now, you would think that choosing the anti-racist option and therefore seriously pressuring Israel, as was done to South Africa, to fundamentally change would be the obvious choice for today's statesmen. But it's not. It's not the obvious choice for them. There is an ongoing effort, we might call it the updated Zionist Project, to move the world backward so as to accept racist past practices. It constitutes an attack on international law that seeks to protect and promote human rights, despite the fact that the origin of much of that international law comes as a reaction to Nazi persecution of Jews in World War II. Doesn't matter. There is an attack on that kind of international law, and an attack on the objectivity and efficacy of the United Nations, also in the area of protection of human rights. It was war and racism that brought the two imperial entities, the British Empire and the World Zionist Organization, together. And it is war and continued justification of racism that by which Israel maintains its survival in our own day. The question for all of us is just how far we want to turn the clock back. Or essentially, we have to organize ourselves to promote the first option, which is that Israel can no longer be a Zionist state, quoted, it's sort of paraphrasing Weizmann, rather than the world go back to colonial practices. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to invite Professor Susan Akram to come up here.
Thank you for coming out in such a freezing cold morning. This is truly the gathering of stalwarts. And in my not-so-brief remarks, I'm afraid, I want to address, I actually want to challenge the received wisdom about Balfour and discuss the question of nationality with regard to Palestinians, the claim of Jewish nationality, and compare Palestinian nationality with the claim of Jewish nationality and self-determination rights of the two peoples in the context of both peoples' territorial claims and as these are affected by Balfour, or were affected by Balfour. And it's important at the outset to define the meaning of the terms citizen and national. They're often used interchangeably, but such usage confuses their distinct legal meaning in many contexts. Moreover, nationality has a legal and a sociological meaning, and the sociological is more commonly understood than the legal. In the latter sense, nationality is taken to mean ethno-national identity, the identification with a particular group considered to have common ethnic origins, Bosnians or Serbs, Kurds, Tamils, or Armenians, regardless of the territory in which they're located. The legal meaning, however, is quite different and refers to the relationship as defined by law between an individual and a particular state or territory. Under classical international law theory, nationality determined which state a person belonged to for purposes of disputes with other states, such as for diplomatic intervention. Since nationality is, and I quote the language of the international court, the link between the individual and international law, it is critical to determine who is a national of a state or a territory, and hence what rights in and to that territory the individual has as a matter of international law. From the legal perspective, the ethno-national identity of a person is irrelevant, as it is the connection the person has to a particular state or territory, that is, his membership in it, which defines his legal nationality. The term citizen is mostly of significance as a matter of the domestic law of states. That is, a state can determine through its internal laws which among its residents have the preferred status of citizenship, with the particular privileges and benefits afforded by that status. Although in classical international law terms the nationality of a person is determined vis-a-vis international law and citizenship by domestic law, the distinction between the two has become less significant with growing importance, the growing importance of human rights law. In the Palestine case, however, and indeed in most of the Arab world, the distinction between the two remains both relevant and critical. So I'll start with Palestinian nationality. The argument that Palestinians have a recognized nationality begins with the Ottoman Empire. Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire from 1516 until 1923. Various changes occurred to the territory, none of which are really important to our nationality question, until the Treaty of Lausanne on 24 July 1923. On 6 August 1924, under the terms of the Lausanne Treaty, Ottoman citizens who resided in the territory of Palestine became Palestinian citizens. As a matter of international law, Palestinian nationality was formed on this date. The Lausanne Treaty also created separate territories, fixed borders, and established separate nationalities for Transjordan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon. Following the Lausanne Treaty, each of these territories, including Palestine, had a citizenship law that codified their nationality status. Under British mandate, during the League of Nations period from 1922 until 1948, Palestinian citizenship was codified by British law, the Palestinian Citizenship Order of 1925, which included the acquisition of Palestinian citizenship through birth in Palestine, primarily. Under the mandate system, the local people were not nationals of the mandate powers, although they could obtain diplomatic protection from the mandate country. The Palestine Citizenship Order afforded Palestinian citizenship to all those who were Turkish subjects or citizens at the time of the Lausanne Treaty and were habitually resident in Palestine. The population meeting this criteria numbered 847,000 people. These included, however, certain foreign residents who immigrated to Palestine between 1920 and 1922, mostly immigrant Jews. By proclamation of September 1922, the British government provided that any person of other than Ottoman nationality, habitually resident in Palestine on that date, might apply for Palestinian citizenship. Approximately 38,000 people were granted Palestine citizenship under that proclamation, mostly Jews. Thus far, aside from the complication of the British mandate itself and the inclusion of the terms of the Balfour Declaration in it, which I'll come to later, the recognition and codification of Palestinian nationality was consistent with international law. It attached to a population that was genuinely and intrinsically linked to a defined territory with specified borders and was passed through blood, residence, or birth on the territory. It was also consistent with the customary law rule that inhabitants found on a territory when there's a change of sovereignty should automatically acquire the nationality of the successor state. The British citizenship law, even granting status to immigrants, was generally consistent with these rules. Under the British citizenship law, Palestinians could obtain passports, and over 70,000 Palestinian passports were issued. So now we come to the Balfour Declaration and what it had to do with the nationality question. By 1901, the World Zionist Organization had established the Jewish National Fund to purchase land for Jewish settlers in Palestine, as well as in other areas in the Middle East and Africa. Theodor Herzl and the WZO envisioned the Zionist project of redeeming the land for Jews as taking land from the Arabs and expelling them from Palestine. The Zionists succeeded, as you heard from Lawrence Davidson, in aligning their plan with British interests in the Middle East. And in 1917, the British cabinet endorsed the letter that became known as the Balfour Declaration. Leila Farsak read the letter. I won't read it again, but simply to point out a few issues about it. The Zionists interpreted the endorsement of the Declaration of Balfour as a British commitment to the Jewish people for the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. First, Britain had no legal authority to create any political entity in Palestine that disregarded the rights of the indigenous Palestinian population, a fact that's actually recognized in the declaration itself. Second, such an interpretation violated the agreement made between the British government and Arab leaders during World War I that guaranteed the independence of the Arabs in all the regions under authority of the Sharif of Mecca once the war had ended, that indisputably included Palestine, as even the British Foreign Office maps showed. Third, there was no legal concept of the Jewish people as a political entity with recognized rights separate from the religious or cultural identity of the Jewish people. Fourth, the history of the Balfour Declaration reflects that the British government itself did not believe that the Zionists represented the rights or interests of the Jewish people. Anti-Zionist Jews, particularly prominent political leaders such as Lord Montague, made it clear to the British government that the Zionists did not represent British Jews, let alone world Jewry. Most important, the British Parliament neither endorsed the Balfour Declaration nor passed it. It was defeated in both houses when put to a parliamentary vote. The only consistent interpretation of the Balfour Declaration with the negotiations and drafting history, Britain's pre-existing obligations under the League of Nations Charter, the mandate and its provision on minority treaties, and with existing international law was that Britain intended to provide for Jews a home in Palestine, but not a homeland, not a Jewish state. In other words, Britain recognized repeatedly in government letters, statements, and actions that it intended to provide a sanctuary for Jews in Palestine without violating the rights of Palestinian Arabs or the rights of Jews in any other country in the world. Nothing in the historical or legal history gives support for a claim that the Balfour Declaration recognized Jewish nationality attached to a distinct population of individuals entitled to self-determination in Palestine. Next, we come to Resolution 181 and the nationality question. This is the next major legal historical development relevant to the question of nationality, and that is Resolution 181, the partition plan of 29 November 1947. First, it's important to note that 181 was a General Assembly resolution, not a Security Council resolution. And under the UN Charter, the General Assembly has no authority to divide territory or to enforce any kind of obligation on states or people. The resolution language itself begins with "the General Assembly recommends." The United Nations as a whole recognized this, as after passage of 181, both the Security Council and Britain, the mandatory power, refused to enforce the partition plan. The UN Secretariat issued an interpretation stating that Resolution 181 has no obligatory character whatsoever. The attempt to take the issue of the legality of 181 to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion was narrowly defeated by states strong-armed by the U.S. and Israel to defeat the effort. Second, it's important to understand the actual provisions of 181. In terms of nationalities, it is true that the British had separated Jewish from Arab nationalities in Palestine in incorporating the Balfour Declaration into the mandate and in granting citizenship to Jews who had entered and remained illegally. Still, the Jews given citizenship were those actually residing in Palestine, not outside. 181's recognition of a Jewish and an Arab state did refer to religious and racial criteria to identify territorial division, but referred to them as the two peoples of Palestine. The plan stated that Palestinian citizens residing in Palestine, as well as the Arabs and Jews, who, not holding Palestinian citizenship, reside in Palestine, shall, upon the recognition of independence, become citizens of the state in which they are resident and enjoy full civil and political rights. This requires careful note. The plan's principle was that Palestinian citizens, regardless of their religion, residing in the Arab state, would become citizens of the Arab state. Palestinian citizens residing in the Jewish state, regardless of their religion, would become citizens of the Jewish state. Moreover, the population demographics on which the partition plan was based were incorrect because they excluded the Arab Bedouins. The British Palestine authorities telegrammed a serious omission to the British Foreign Office upon release of the plan for partition. It's important enough to quote. It said, "The immediately striking feature of the plan is that on the committee's own figures, including 90,000 Bedouins, the Jewish state would contain more Arabs than Jews. The Arab population is larger than any the plan has seriously propounded." Finally, the resolution required a one-year period prior to recognition of independence of either state, during which time both states had to incorporate constitutions that provided for equal rights for all citizens with no discrimination. Thus, the partition plan did not authorize either state to institutionalize superior rights for any religious or racial group. Aside from recommending partition of territory that was not within its authority, the General Assembly's plan of how division was to be made, that is, on the basis of habitual residents and citizens already on each territory was on its terms consistent with international law. It preserved Palestinian nationality stemming from the Lausanne Treaty and the British citizenship laws of Palestine. Nothing in Resolution 181 gives support for a claim of Jewish nationality other than those Jews habitually resident in Palestine, eligible for Palestinian citizenship living on the territory. There's several other documents I don't really have time to go through. Resolution 194 has something to say about the nationality issue and Israeli citizenship nationality law. But let me end with talking about the Jewish claims of nationality. Is there a Jewish nationality? Israel granted two-tiered citizenship under its nationality law after it became a state. But that must also be scrutinized for conformance with international law. Israeli nationality law created a legal fiction. There is no such thing as Israeli nationality, as the Israeli High Court itself has confirmed. Israeli law, official institutions, or records do not recognize an Israeli nationality status. Israel's Interior Ministry lists over 100 nationality. No Israeli nationality is listed. The only nationality to which rights and privileges are attached is Jewish nationality. Jewish claims of nationality and self-determination must be clearly distinguished from the claims of Israeli Jews to nationality and self-determination as a matter of international law. Israel proclaimed her state on behalf of the Jewish people, a concept which, until today, grants rights to and within the state on an extraterritorial basis. When it enacted its citizenship law in 1950, it granted nationality, as I said, to Jews only, repealing the Palestine citizenship law passed by Britain. The people entitled to national status in the Jewish state, defined under the partition resolution, included both Jews and Palestinians already residing in the territory, all of whom were to be granted equal rights under constitution to be enforced in both states prior to UN recognition. So what is the status of Palestinian nationality today, and what relevance does it have to our question? On the one hand, there's an argument that Palestinians continue to retain Palestinian nationality to the present. This is based on the historical and legal facts I've described, and that Israel's revocation of Palestinian citizenship and denaturalization of Palestinians was illegal, and its denial of Palestinian return is also illegal. The argument rests on the claim that Israel's acts, being illegal, do not affect Palestinian nationality as a matter of international law, and that that nationality remains unbroken despite the inability of the majority of Palestinians to return to their homes. And I'll end with the argument that Palestinians lost their nationality in 1948, and those unable to meet the criteria of Israel's law of nationality having become stateless. My contention is that this is a weaker argument, both legally and in terms of its consequences for Palestinians and Palestinian refugees, in particular with regard to the right of return. In the Western states, this is marginally helpful, that is, designating Palestinians as stateless, because there have been no advantages to Palestinians from that definition. It's my contention that Palestinians have been right in maintaining that their Palestinian nationality remains intact today, that they are not stateless, and their right of return is based squarely on their rights as nationals of Palestine, not just as refugees. Moreover, there's no parallel legal authority, whether in the Balfour Declaration, in 181, in 194, or any subsequent resolutions, for a claim of Jewish nationality that negates Palestine national rights. Advocacy on right of return for Palestinians as nationals, not as stateless persons, and not just as refugees, should be clearly framed around the language and principles underlying Resolution 181, Resolution 194, and the illegality of Israel's so-called nationality law. Thank you.
I'd like to invite our last speaker, Tom Suarez, to come up.
Quickly, I'd like to mention an extremely important book, Palestine, the Reality, which was written by a journalist at the time, published in 1940. Most copies were destroyed in the German Blitz. It has now been newly republished and is available here, thanks to Interlink Books. The Balfour Declaration unleashed a campaign of Zionist terrorism that is shockingly at odds with the prevailing narrative of Israel's birth, and more to the point, the very nature of Zionism. This history is not in question. It is preserved in British source documents, in mainstream media of the day, and in Zionist records. Today's tragedy in Israel-Palestine cannot be detached from this history of terrorism because the so-called conflict is that ongoing history. Balfour's legacy typically conjures images of the dispossession of non-Jewish Palestinians. Missing from this snapshot is the parallel violence against Jews that Balfour's signature set loose. Like its violence against the Palestinians, Zionism's anti-Jewish violence took two forms: physical violence and dehumanization, what one might call spiritual violence. For both peoples, the physical violence was to force mass human migration, just as Palestinians could not be removed from the land except by violence against them. Zionism could not install a critical mass of Jews in their place without violence against Jews. For Palestinians, this was ethnic cleansing and massacres, as well as starving them off the land by expropriating all means of livelihood. For Jews, the violence was more camouflaged. Its principal forms were the blocking of any safe haven outside of Palestine, manufactured violence to force the uprooting of Jews living elsewhere in peace, and the indoctrination of Jewish DPs, displaced people, and children into Zionist messianic fundamentalism. But all this is violence against civilians to force a political goal. That is to say, the Zionist project itself is by its very nature one of terrorism. And so Zionism needed two antidotes. One, it needed to reframe its terrorism as defense, which it accomplished by dehumanizing the Palestinians, the obstacle to its settler state, into an eternal threat, irredeemably violent as a race. And two, it needed extraordinary impunity, for which it dehumanized Jews, the means to its settler state. Zionism achieved this impunity by dehumanizing Jews into the settler state itself. Israel acts as the very embodiment of Jews, Jewish history, culture, and persecution, expropriating these and all they symbolize back to the Jewish kingdoms cited in the Old Testament, of which it claims to be the rebirth. And it reinforces this messianic facade by expropriating relevant archaeological artifacts as artifacts of the nation-state's history. In closed discussions, Ben-Gurion made no pretense about the cynicism of this. The reason they would call their state Israel, he said, was to get Jews to go there. It was brilliant marketing, and the military value of this is staggering, reducing Jewry to a human shield for the settler state and enabling Israel to frame criticism of it as criticism of Jews themselves, thus making criticism anti-Semitic by definition. But inescapably, this means that all Jews, simply because they are Jews, are then guilty of whatever the Israeli state does. Thus, Zionism, if we accept it, succeeds where all the bigots through the centuries never could. If we accept it, Zionism corrupts Jewry itself from within. And so the oft-heard question, does anti-Zionism necessarily equal anti-Semitism, is backwards. The question should be, is Zionism necessarily anti-Semitic? The Zionist cause was always held sacrosanct above all else, even during World War II, and even when it frustrated the Allies' war efforts. And with the Allied victory, Zionism continued to claim its tribal, extranational ownership over the war's Jewish survivors. It did not matter what, given the honest opportunity, the survivors might have wished for themselves as their individual self-determination. They were segregated from non-Jewish survivors and put into Zionist-run camps that were nothing short of indoctrination factories, tolerating no deviance from Zionist orthodoxy. Opportunities for hundreds of thousands of new homes in safe countries, like the United States and Britain, were sabotaged by Zionist leaders who needed the DPs to populate their settler state. A kidnapping campaign was waged to remove children of Jewish background from their adoptive European families because Zionism needed the children as facts on the ground. European Jewish children still in the camps were blocked from new homes, even new Jewish homes, if those homes were not in Palestine. Propaganda events, most famously the vessel Exodus, were staged at the expense of the welfare of Jewish survivors who were turned into sympathy victims and then forgotten once the theater was over. Jewish communities in the Middle East and North Africa were subjected to scare propaganda and false flag terrorism to ethnically cleanse Jews from their homelands to become second-class ethnic fodder in Israel. And when, in the 1980s, Jews were able to leave Russia and emigrate to the United States, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, former bigwig of the terror gang Lehi, successfully coerced U.S. President Reagan to close U.S. doors to them. It is consummate irony, then, that Zionism is now being flaunted as Jewish self-determination. It is exactly the opposite. It is the hijacking of that individual self-identity and self-determination, and the hijacking of that individual self-identity and self-determination by a political project that has been the cause of a century of misery, displacement, and death. Balfour and the other officials responsible knew in 1917, knew all along, that the Declaration's polite phrase about no harm coming to the Palestinians was a lie. It was never a failure of good intentions. And as the years passed, the determination to seize and ethnically cleanse Palestine remained the explicit plan of the top Zionist leaders, Ben-Gurion, Weizmann, etc. Balfour lived long enough to see his signature translate into Zionist anti-Jewish violence. By 1924, the allegedly defensive Haganah, what would become the Israeli military, was already assassinating Jews for their opposition to Zionism. But Balfour did not live quite long enough to lose hope that the Zionists would double as surrogate empire builders for Britain. Rather, Zionist terrorism continued through World War II and by 1946 was tearing Palestine apart as the Palestinians maintained stoic nonviolence. Anyone or anything that kept Palestine a functioning society was a target of the Zionists. Trains, roads, bridges, communications, oil facilities, and Coast Guard stations were constantly being bombed. Soldiers, utility workers, telephone repairmen, railway workers, bomb disposal personnel, anyone coming forward to help stop the terror were murdered. Police, and especially Jewish police, were long a favorite target of the Zionists and were gunned down by the dozens. That Jewish children were indoctrinated and exploited was obvious at least as early as 1938, when the British caught the bomber of a Palestinian bus. She was 12 years old, egged on by three adults. Teenagers were commonly used for terror attacks, and those who resisted involvement in the militias were blocked from advancement in school. Among the smaller terror organizations that popped up was one specifically dedicated to preventing Jews from befriending non-Jews, the ultimate fear, of course, being polluting what for the Zionists was the pure Jewish race. As a sample of its methods, the terror group doused a disobedient Jewish girl with acid, severely injuring her and blinding her in one eye. illustrative of the degree to which Zionist plans infiltrated the government in everyday life, a couple of months after one Coast Guard station was attacked and bombed by the Haganah, it blew up again, but the British were baffled because this time there had been no attack. It just blew up. They discovered that the construction crew that had rebuilt the station after the previous attack were Haganah and had simply embedded explosives in the reconstruction. But the worst problem of infiltration was in the military service, where deadly sabotage by Zionist plants who had joined the forces led, tragically, to orders to remove all Jews from service in Palestine because there was no way to tell them from the Zionists. By 1948, this problem spread to key medical personnel. After the Jewish agency poisoned the water supply of Acre with typhoid in order to expedite the ethnic cleansing of this city that lies on the Palestinian side of partition, the bacteriologist hired by the British proved to be a Haganah plant or sympathizer, an obstacle to the availability of the vaccine. Nor did Balfour live long enough to see his signature spread terrorism to Europe and Britain. His own embassy in Rome bombed. Allied trains in Austria, bombed. Government buildings in London, bombed. And a concerted, though almost entirely unsuccessful, campaign of letter bombs. 30 years and 27 days after Balfour signed his name, the UN capitulated to Zionist terrorism and passed UN Resolution 181 with its implicit creation of the Israeli state. The alternate UN plan was for a binational state, but this compromise would be, to quote British documents, totally unacceptable to the Zionists, and, quote, would therefore be followed by an intensification of Jewish terrorism. That is, yet greater terrorism over that which had already brought Palestine to its knees. The disproportionately large land area the UN gave the Zionists in Resolution 181 was also a capitulation to Zionist terrorism. Again, quoting British sources, giving the Zionists so much land up front was an attempt to delay, not prevent, but merely delay the Zionist expansionist wars that they knew would come. But this appeasement, of course, failed because within a few months of Resolution 181, the Zionist militias were already waging their first expansionist war, confiscating more than half of the Palestinian side of partition. In the words of the High Commissioner at the time, the Zionists were jubilant with their campaign of calculated aggression coupled with brutality, the torturing of terrified women and children. And the Zionist persecution of Jews who displease them has, quote, reached medieval standards. The armistice that ended the 1948 war established a ceasefire line, essentially what would become known as the 67 borders, that, to quote from the agreement, is not to be construed in any sense as a political or territorial boundary. Israel was supposed to return to the agreed partition or other mutually agreed alternative, but it simply refused. Even if one accepts the legality of partition, the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land began then, in 1948, not in 1967. Fast forward to today, and what is the living legacy of Britain's arrogance in giving away other people's land? Generations of people are condemned to life in camps because they are the wrong ethnicity. People live under a ruthless military occupation because they are the wrong ethnicity. And Gaza has been reduced to a laboratory for sadism and weapons proving. Were Balfour to be alive today, perhaps what for him would be the greatest irony is how his living declaration now corrupts British politics and censors speech and debate in Britain on behalf of the foreign state his signature helped jumpstart. The conflict could end tomorrow if the complicit nations, the United States, Britain, and the various European countries, stop enabling it. And lest this claim seem exaggerated, just imagine for a moment how the international community would react if the ethnicities in this so-called conflict were reversed. If the ethnicities were reversed, the international community would rush their militaries to the region to stop precisely what it now empowers and finances. It would suddenly demand an immediate end to race laws and apartheid and the creation of a secular democratic state of equals. And the international community would jump to proclaim that equality, obviously, means the unqualified right of return. It would suddenly be self-evident that you can't ethnically cleanse people and then say that equality does not apply to them because they're not present. The British government's refusal to acknowledge the sins of its predecessors is disgraceful, but it is the United States that since the mid-1940s has been the principal torchbearer of the Balfour Declaration, and so as Americans, it is our moral responsibility to make it history. Thank you.
You have been listening to Lawrence Davidson, Susan Ockram, and Thomas Suarez speaking at the conference on Balfour's Legacy, Confronting the Consequences, held in Cambridge, Massachusetts on November 11th of 2017.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind.
When the consent of the governed becomes a joke, despots fill the political void. They give vent to popular anger and frustration while arming the state to do to the majority what it has long done to the minority. This tale is as old as civilization. It was played out in ancient Greece and Rome, the Soviet Union, fascist Germany, fascist Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Once a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate, it creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. The crisis we face is the result of a four-decade-long slow-motion corporate coup d'etat that has left corporations and the war machine omnipotent. The problem is the corporate state, and until we dismantle that, we are doomed.
You're listening to episode 749 of Unwelcome Guests, on the rise and fall of U.S. corporatocracy. I'm Robin Upton, and that was Chris Hedges, who's going to be speaking on the state of life in the US in 2017. And we're going to hear mostly on the rise of corporatocracy, on how the deep state, the small cabal who took over control of the US government, how they systematically dismantled bits of society that they didn't want, specifically democratic government and the family. Bit on the fall of the US corporatocracy. Yeah, still to happen slightly. So we're going to have a look at historical parallels about how the same pattern has been repeated throughout history. We're going to be looking at particularly the last 40 years, at the policies in US society, largely unremarked upon by the distraction that is corporate politics. Let's get a historical perspective. We're going to hear about the fascist coup in the early 1930s, which was foiled by the integrity of General Smedley Butler. This is called the business plot, such as it exists on Wikipedia. You could find out a little bit about it. There's not much more, I'm afraid, on WikiSpooks. It's worth looking at. And it references episode 229 of this show, which you could try if you wanted more details. Thanks to Tony Gosling for posting this MP3.
which I found on Radio for All. And that was this year. I don't know where it's from, I'm afraid. And it does finish rather abruptly. But it is nevertheless a good introduction to one of the little forgotten corners of US history, which you're not going to hear about in government schools.
On the 21st of November 1934, the following rather chilling article appeared in the New York Times. It concerns the discovery of a planned coup that could have altered the course of American history. Yet today, hardly anyone knows anything about it.
A plot of Wall Street interest to overthrow President Roosevelt and establish a fascist dictatorship, backed by a private army of 500,000 ex-soldiers and others, appeared before the House of Representatives Committee on Un-American Activities, which began hearings on the charges.
If these long-forgotten accounts can be relied on, I seem to be looking at an attempt to set up a fascist government in the land of the free. A coup that could have toppled one of America's most revered presidents, paved the way for a possible alliance with Italy and Germany, and thereby changed the complexion of World War II.
Fascism was seen as an example to be learned from, because it seemed like a quick fix. All you needed to do was get people to shape up.
You could have had a handful of the wealthiest people in the United States found guilty of treason and sentenced to death.
But just what was this plot? Who were the Wall Street interests? Or was this nothing more than a moment of paranoia from a national media not renowned for its self-restraint? Well, the answers to some of these questions may have to wait until I can get my hands on the bulk of the evidence, documents detailing evidence heard behind closed doors by a congressional committee. But I already have the official statement released by that committee when it reported back to Congress. Its members clearly had no doubt that a fascist coup was in the offing.
In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient.
So, such a plot, backed by powerful people, was waiting in the wings. That much is very clear. But how did it come to this? Well, it all happened during one of the bleakest moments in U.S. history.
They used to tell me I was building a dream.
The America of 1933 was in the teeth of the Great Depression, a time of extreme poverty, desperation, and the barren plains of the grapes of wrath.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day.
Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The Great Depression is not called the Great Depression in this country by accident.
Michael Kazin is professor of history at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
It was the deepest and the longest economic downturn in American history. As many as one-third of the labor force was unemployed in the early 1930s especially. The core of the industrial economy was all but shut down.
Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
All of this added to a sense that American society was coming apart, not just the economy. People no longer had much faith in the authorities at any level, economic or political.
Yet the image of those days we've been left with is not social unrest, fascism and treasonous plots, but one of dignified suffering and resilient faith in the American dream. No one illustrated that better than President Franklin D. Roosevelt, whose New Deal reforms promised jobs, pride and fresh hope to ordinary Americans.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
FDR's New Deal policies brought an increase in public work programs, more help for the poor, and the removal of the dollar from the gold standard. Yet while history remembers FDR as a visionary saviour in America's hour of need, some at the time saw him in a very different light.
There were major elements in the business community that hated Roosevelt. And they hated Roosevelt out of all proportion to the scale of the measures that he had actually brought in.
Professor Tony Badger is Master of Clare College, Cambridge, and author of several books on Roosevelt's New Deal.
These were businessmen who essentially thought that Roosevelt was putting America on the wrong road in a big way in 1933, and that it was setting the federal government up as a sort of arbiter and enforcer and intervener in the American economy in a way that they were deeply afraid of.
Such powerful enemies had been made within 100 days of FDR taking office in 1933.
The businessmen were also aware that out in the country there were demagogues who were making really popular, apparently radical-sounding appeals, and they were always worried that Roosevelt was unleashing these forces, would encourage these, what they thought of as crackpots, to wreak havoc.
The right wing in America wasn't going to sit back and let this happen. Although its members were a curious alliance of rich and poor, north and south, they were united by one central concern. America was changing in a way they didn't like. Professor Kazin.
The idea that the government would create jobs, the idea that these jobs would be given to all religious groups and all racial groups was very threatening. And so a lot of people who didn't like what Roosevelt seemed to be doing with the government didn't like it, partly because the very people who were cheering Roosevelt were people who this still majority of white Protestant Americans believed should not have any power at all in government, should be subservient.
American society was fracturing along racial lines as well as political ones, and the right was sensing a new power.
There were insurgencies we could call sort of proto-fascist, groups called the Silver Legion, the Silver Shirts, the Black Legion. Most of these groups were continuing some of the themes of the Ku Klux Klan, and these groups often carried out vigilante violence against Catholic workers, black workers in some of the factories in the North. These groups had great aspirations to become much larger than they were. Some of them had aspirations to imitate what had happened in Italy and was happening in Germany.
It's into this world that the plot to overthrow FDR was born. But who was going to lead it, and how did they think they'd get away with it? I'm hoping the answers lie amongst the formerly secret papers of the Congressional Committee that investigated the planned coup. These, I'm told, are locked away in the National Archives of America, a few hundred yards from the White House in downtown Washington.
Well, this seems to be it, the National Archives Research Center. Fantastically grand building. Looks like there's strict security in operation here. Airport scanner machine. Hello, I'm from the BBC. I've got an appointment with archivist Jessica Kratz.
Okay. Hold on 1 second, let me give you a call.
Thank you very much.
Jessica led me down increasingly claustrophobic corridors into the heart of the archive.
This is staff area. Legislative records, here, watch your head.
The documents I'm after are from a committee known as the McCormack-Dickstein Committee, after the two men who chaired it.
Okay, so here are the papers. Committee papers, kind of organized by, you know, this file code here, HR 73A-F.
And Special Committee on Un-American Activities on Nazi Propaganda.
It was established to investigate the activities of fascist sympathizers in the U.S. in the early years of Roosevelt's presidency.
It's a very small amount. Only, what, four and a half boxes for what they did in executive session.
So it doesn't look that much, and there's even less than it looks.
For what the committee investigated and how much testimony they heard, yes, I mean, it's a very small amount.
Despite the paucity of documents, there are some that catch my eye.
Starts with some interesting disputes between the general and the committee. The chairman, General, you are a retired commandant of the Marine Corps.
The most important testimony in these records is from a senior commander of the U.S. Marines, Major General Smedley Butler.
I was in the Marine Corps 33 years and 4 months on the active list.
Major General Butler came before the committee of his own free will. He had, he said, been contacted by a well-connected New York City broker called Gerald Maguire. Maguire met Butler a number of times and slowly revealed his audacious plan. He and his financial backers wanted Butler, a highly decorated war hero, hugely respected by rank-and-file soldiers, to rouse an army of World War I veterans, many of whom were angry that a bonus they'd been promised had yet to be paid. The idea was that the general would use these men to help seize the White House, just like Hitler and Mussolini had used their private armies to bully their way into power. At the time, Butler, a staunch defender of democracy, went along with the plan, but he was secretly appalled. Inside the National Archives, I was joined by writer John Buchanan, who has made a study of right-wing America in the 1930s.
These super wealthy capitalists essentially wanted to pose such a threat to Roosevelt that he would basically step aside. If FDR would not cooperate and step aside, they would execute him, kill him.
Smedley Butler's testimony shows the plot was at an advanced stage.
Maguire said to me, "I went abroad to study the part that the veterans play in the various setups of the governments that they have abroad, like France, and I found just exactly the organization we're going to have. It is an organization of 500,000 super soldiers here in America." "Well," I said, "I suppose you get these 500,000 men in America. What are you going to do with them?" He said, "Did it ever occur to you that the president is overworked? We might have an assistant president." He went on to say that the position would be a secretary of general affairs, a sort of super secretary. He said, "You know the American people will swallow that. We have got the newspapers. We will start a campaign that the president's health is failing. Everybody can tell that by looking at him. And the dumb American people will fall for it in a second."
Now in his 90s, Jules Archer was a young man of 18 when General Smedley Butler gave his testimony. He remembers just how idolized the man still was by the tens of thousands of veterans who'd been under his command.
"He was a fantastic anti-war general. He was very popular with the soldiers and sailors. He fought for them, and he fought for their rights. That was one of the reasons he was selected for the plot, because they knew he could raise a paramilitary army of veterans who would follow him, because they believed in him."
It was here at the Association of the Bar in central New York City, just a stone's throw from Wall Street, that the case against the plotters came to a head. The chief witness, Major General Smedley Butler, walked up these steps past the giant stone pillars that tower above me here and through the rather elegant doors. Even today, all the officers on either side of me, behind the large wooden doors, are packed with people who are going through today's important legal cases. But back on Tuesday, the 20th of November, 1934, this was perhaps the most serious case the country could possibly have faced. And the room where it all took place is up several flights of stairs in what's known as the supper room.
One of the most important witnesses who came here was Paul Cumley French, a journalist Smedley Butler took into his confidence after the conspirators had tried to recruit him. French had also met chief plotter Gerald Maguire at his Wall Street offices, and he recounted their conversation to the committee.
"We need a fascist government in this country," he insisted, "to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built in America. The only men who have the patriotism to do it are the soldiers, and Smedley Butler is the ideal leader. He could organize a million men overnight." During the course of the conversation, he continually discussed the need of a man on a white horse, as he called it, a dictator who would come galloping in on his white horse. He said that was the only way to save the capitalistic system.
But it was Smedley Butler, war hero and soldier's friend, who exposed the plot. he continued his meetings with Maguire until he gathered enough information on the plotters to bring the evidence before the McCormack-Dickstein Committee. But given that there were no recordings of these meetings or letters written by Maguire outlining his plans, how can we be sure that the General didn't exaggerate or even make up the whole story? Jules Archer, who went on to study the lives of Smedley Butler and Representative John McCormack, is convinced the plot was real. He remembers talking to McCormack about his time as chairman of the committee that investigated the case.
McCormack was a veteran politician. He was an advisor to Roosevelt and other presidents. He had a heavy Irish accent. He told me, "General Smedley Butler was one of the outstanding Americans in our history. I cannot emphasize too strongly the very important part he played in exposing the fascist plot in the early 1930s, backed by and planned by persons possessing tremendous wealth." And there was no doubt about it that McCormack was absolutely convinced that Butler was telling the truth.
"On the North Axis of talks on the Nazi movement in the United States, we present Representative Dickstein."
In this early radio archive, you can just make out the other co-chairman, Representative Samuel Dickstein, warning Americans to be aware of the threat from fascist forces from within.
"We have succeeded in unearthing evidence to define the Nazi government here as the most dangerous threat to our democracy that has ever existed."
And the central character of the plot, the plain-speaking Major General Smedley Butler, was caught on early newsreel from the time explaining his part in exposing the plot.
"I talked with an investigator for this committee. He told me they had unearthed evidence linking my name with several such veteran organizations. As it then seemed to me to be getting serious, I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institution."
So Smedley Butler remained adamant that he was the target of a fascist plot, and there was never any doubt either in the mind of committee chairman John McCormack that the forces of fascism were gathering to storm the White House. But who was going to fund the coup? Even with the backing of 500,000 veterans, a plot of this sort against the most powerful government on earth needs money as well as muscle, and an awful lot of it too. Well, according to Smedley Butler, this was where the big business moguls and Wall Street brokers behind the coup came in. They, he was told by Maguire, would soon step out of the shadows in the form of a newly created lobby group. Soon after he made this promise to Butler, the American Liberty League was born. John Buchanan.
Maguire said, "Well, you're going to see in the next few weeks in the press, this organization is going to be created that's going to front for the whole thing, and we're going to stand up for the Constitution, and we're going to stand up for our troops and so on." And lo and behold, about 2 weeks later, splashed all over the major newspapers of the time, especially in New York and Washington, the creation of the American Liberty League.
To get a flavor of the ideology that motivated the Liberty League, here's one of their leading supporters, Demarest Lloyd, writing in his magazine, Affairs.
"Popular government is a perilous extravagance in time of emergency. The present situation is more destructive than war, and much more difficult for a popular government to handle. It is quite apparent that unless confusion is to become chaos, Congress, like a long line of unfit rulers in the past, should abdicate."
It's a matter of record that the membership of the American Liberty League included some of the most famous names in business. Its benefactors read like a who's who of household products that are still familiar today. General Foods, the makers of Maxwell House coffee, Birdseye and Colgate, Heinz Foods, U.S. Steel and car manufacturer General Motors were all supporters of the League.
These are industrial individual titans of industry, and they talked to each other and they wound each other up into ever-increasing frenzy and denunciation of the men in the White House. They become quite a fevered, conspiracy-oriented group of individuals. They are the people who go on to form the American Liberty League.
The treasurer of this organisation was the broker Grayson Murphy. Little research has revealed that he was none other than the boss of the man at the centre of the plot allegations, Gerald Maguire. Later in the McCormack-Dickstein report, a shipping company called Hamburg America Line was accused of providing free passage to Germany to American journalists willing to write favourable copy on Hitler's rise to power. The company is also alleged to have brought Nazi spies and pro-fascist sympathisers into America. John Buchanan has studied this later section of the report and has discovered that one of the company's managers came from a very famous family.
The thing that surprised me most was to discover in the documents that this company, Hamburg America Lines, had in fact been managed on the U.S. side at the executive level by Prescott Bush as part of a web of Nazi business interests that were all seized in late 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act by the U.S. Congress. And Prescott Bush is the grandfather of the sitting president of the United States.
Of course, at the time, it was perfectly legal to have dealings with Hitler's Germany. Prescott Bush was not called to account for this until America entered the war. Neither was it a crime to be a member of a lobby group like the Liberty League, and I found no firm evidence that the Liberty League itself was behind the plot to overthrow their country's democratically elected president. But academics like Professor Tony Badger believes that it was, at the very least, a magnet for those with such intentions.
It would always surprise me if they had been really, there had been a lot of very fine-tuned planning. But the sense that forces that might be unleashed by the New Deal posed such a threat that desperate measures might be needed does ring true.
But yet again, the evidence is hard to find. You'd have thought that if there was any linking leading American industrialists of the day to a plot against the president, I'd be able to find it at the National Archives in Washington. Yet when John Buchanan and I leafed through the rather thin files there, we found no direct reference to any of these people. Though I'm now starting to wonder whether any such evidence has been removed or deliberately withheld from the records in the first place. General Butler seemed to have harboured similar suspicions. After the investigating committee published its findings, he accused its members of deliberately editing out of his testimony the names of top business people who he'd linked to the plot. On the 17th of February 1935, just after the committee had published its findings, he had this to say on Radio WCAU.
Like most committees, it has slaughtered the little and allowed the big to escape. The big shots weren't even called to testify. They were all mentioned in the testimony. Why was all mention of these names suppressed from the testimony?
The co-chairman, Samuel Dickstein, admits that the papers were censored, but insisted that this was for a very good reason.
The testimony given by General Butler was kept confidential until such time as the names of the persons who were mentioned could be checked upon and verified. This accounts for the fact that when the results of the hearings were made public, references were omitted.
That argument would have seemed fair enough if names had later been checked and verified. Yet most of the senior figures implicated in General Smedley Butler's evidence were never asked to appear before the committee to answer the questions raised. Even though, had the allegations against them been found to be true, people like Irene DuPont and banker J.P. Morgan could have faced the death sentence for treason.
The investigations mysteriously turn to vapor when it comes time to call them to testify. FDR's main interest was getting the New Deal passed. And so he struck a deal in which it was agreed that the plotters would walk free if Wall Street would back off of their opposition to the New Deal and let FDR do what he wanted.
John Buchanan. With their cover blown, it seems likely that the plotters and their wealthy backers had little option but to accept such a deal and return to the business they knew best, making money. But what chance would such a coup have had anyway? Even with millions of dollars and 500,000 veterans at their disposal, could the plotters ever have pulled it off against the armed forces of a great power like the US? Well, according to Professor Tony Badger, back then, it might not have been quite as difficult as it now seems.
The American army was anything but powerful in 1933. The peacetime army had been reduced to, 130,000, scattered all over the United States. It was a depressing and soul-destroying business being an army officer in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. So I think the sense that the American army as such was a powerful group that could have put down any trouble, it has to be seen in that context.
Though Professor William Becker of George Washington University insists that defeating the Federal Army would only be the first of many big challenges still facing the coup leaders.
I just remain extremely skeptical about this because the U.S. government was, in fact, very, very decentralized. When one talks about, you know, seizing power, I just think it would be extremely difficult given the decentralized nature of the government. There would have been enormous resistance to that.
Professor William Becker, perhaps the biggest remaining question is whether, had the coup gone ahead and been successful, the American people would ever have put up with a dictator in the White House. It seems unlikely. After all, this is a nation that describes itself as the land of the free, the home of democracy. But Professor Michael Kazin is not quite so dismissive. He believes that if we today are ready to accept the loss of some of our liberties in return for personal security, might Americans of the Great Depression have been just as ready to sacrifice some of their freedoms for food, jobs, and financial security?
People wanted security. I mean, the key word in the 30s, as now for that matter, was security. Social security, of course, health security. And Americans, I think, in the 30s cared more about security than they did about democracy. And so if a group of businessmen, with the help of some people, former military people or current military people, could have fairly quickly brought the economy back, created this sense of security, then yes, it is possible that they would have gotten some popular support.
America would have become a dictatorship. Democracy would be gone. America would have joined Hitler and Mussolini as a fascist triumphant.
Now, we continue with unwelcome guests regular. This is Chris Hedges. I've posted a video of this presentation online at our webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/749. He's speaking in Portland in 2017 at the KABU Stop Fascism event. And I've trimmed a little bit of hesitation and audience applause to fit this within the required time frame.
The decision by the deep state in ancient Rome, like the United States in 2017, dominated by a bloated military and corrupt oligarchy, to strangle the Emperor Commodus in his bath in the year 192, did not halt the growing chaos and precipitous decline of the Roman Empire. Commodus, like a number of other late Roman empires, and like Donald Trump, was incompetent and consumed by his own vanity. He commissioned innumerable statues of himself as Hercules and had little interest in governance. He used his position as head of state to make himself the star of his own ongoing public show. He fought victoriously as a gladiator in the arena in fixed bouts. Power for Commodus, as it is for Trump, was primarily about catering to his bottomless narcissism, hedonism, and lust for wealth. He sold public offices so the ancient equivalents of Betsy DeVos and Steve Mnuchin could orchestrate a vast kleptocracy. Commodus was replaced by the reformer Pertinax, the Bernie Sanders of his day, who attempted to curb the unchecked power of the Praetorian Guards, the ancient version of the military-industrial complex. This effort saw the Praetorian Guards assassinate Pertinax after 3 months in office. The Guards then auctioned off the office of emperor to the highest bidder. The next emperor, Didius Julianus, lasted 66 days. There would be 5 emperors in 193 AD, the year after the assassination of Commodus. Trump and our decaying empire have ominous historical precedents. If the deep state replaces Trump, whose ineptitude and imbecility are embarrassing to the empire, that action will not restore our democracy any more than replacing Commodus restored the Republic to Rome. The choice is between inept fascists like Trump and competent fascists like Pence. Our republic is dead. The idiots, seeing in the decay the chance for personal advancement and profit, take over in the final days of crumbling civilizations. Idiot generals wage endless, unwinnable wars that bankrupt the nation. Idiot economists call for reducing taxes for the rich and cutting social service programs for the poor, and project economic growth on the basis of myth. Idiot industrialists poison the water, the soil, and the air, slash jobs, and depress wages. Idiot bankers gamble on self-created financial bubbles and impose crippling debt peonage on the citizens. Idiot journalists and public intellectuals pretend despotism is democracy. Idiot intelligence operatives orchestrate the overthrowing of foreign governments to create lawless enclaves that give rise to enraged fanatics. And idiot professors, experts, and specialists busy themselves with unintelligible jargon and arcane theory that buttress the policies of the rulers. Idiot entertainers and producers create lurid spectacles of sex, gore, and fantasy. There is a familiar checklist for extinction. We are ticking off every item on it. The idiots know only one word, more. They are unencumbered by common sense. They hoard wealth and resources until workers cannot make a living and the infrastructure collapses. They live in privileged compounds where they eat chocolate cake and order missile strikes. They see the state as a projection of their own vanity. The Roman, Mayan, French, Habsburg, Ottoman, Romanov, Wilhelmine, Pahlavi, and Soviet dynasties crumbled because the whims and obsessions of ruling idiots were law. Trump is the face of our collective idiocy. He is what lies behind the mask of our professed civility and rationality, a sputtering, narcissistic, bloodthirsty megalomaniac. This face in the past was hidden, at least to most white Americans, but with the destruction of democratic institutions and the disempowerment of the citizen, the oligarchs and the kleptocrats have become brazen. They no longer need to pretend. They steal and lie openly. They wield armies and fleets against the wretched of the earth, blithely ignore the looming catastrophe caused by global warming, and cannibalize the nation, while at night, like some monster from the Grand Guignol, the idiot-in-chief, overseeing our self-immolation, sits slack-jawed in front of a television set before opening his beautiful Twitter account. Forget the firing of James Comey. Forget the paralysis in Congress. Forget the inanity of a press that covers our descent into tyranny as if it were a sports contest between corporate Republicans and corporate Democrats or a reality show starring our maniacal president. Forget the noise. The crisis we face is not embodied in the public images of the politicians that run our dysfunctional government. The crisis we face is the result of a four-decade-long slow-motion corporate coup d'etat that has left corporations and the war machine omnipotent, turned our electoral system into legalized bribery, and elevated public figures who master the arts of entertainment and artifice. Trump is the symptom. He is not the disease. Our descent into despotism began with the pardoning of Richard Nixon, all of whose impeachable crimes are now legal. And the extrajudicial assault, including targeted assassinations and imprisonment, carried out on dissidents and radicals, especially black radicals. This assault, done in the name of law and order, put the organs of internal security, from the FBI to Homeland Security, beyond the reach of the law. It began with the creation of corporate-funded foundations and organizations that took control of the press, the courts, the universities, scientific research, and the two major political parties. It began with empowering militarized police to kill unarmed citizens and the spread of a horrendous system of mass incarceration and the death penalty. It began with the stripping away of our most basic constitutional rights, privacy, due process, habeas corpus, fair elections, and dissent. It began when big money was employed by political operatives such as Roger Stone, a close advisor to Trump, who created negative political advertisements and spread malicious gossip and false narratives, all eagerly amplified by a media devoted to profits and ratings rather than truth, to deceive the public until political debate became burlesque. The ruling elites, terrified by the mobilization of the left in the 1960s, or by what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called America's excess of democracy, built counter-institutions to delegitimize and marginalize critics of corporate capitalism and imperialism. They bought the allegiances of the two main political parties. They imposed obedience to the neoliberal ideology within academia and the press. This campaign, laid out by Lewis Powell in his 1971 memorandum titled Attack on American Free Enterprise System, was the blueprint for the creeping coup d'etat that 45 years later is complete. Our failure to defend the rights of those who are demonized and persecuted leaves us all demonized and persecuted. Our failure to demand justice for everyone leaves us all without justice. Our failure to halt the crushing of popular movements that stand unequivocally with the oppressed leaves us all oppressed. Our failure to protect our democracy leaves us without a democracy. The persecution of the radicals of four decades ago is not ancient history. It is the genesis of the present. It spawned the corporate coup and the machinery of state terror. We will pay for our complacency. We are trapped like rats in a cage. A con artist may be turning the electric shocks on and off, but the problem is the corporate state. And until we dismantle that, we are doomed. Racist, violent, and despotic forces have always been part of the American landscape. They have often been tolerated and empowered by the state to persecute poor people of color and dissidents. These forces are denied absolute power as long as a majority of citizens have a say in their own governance. But once citizens are locked out of government and denied a voice, power shifts into the hands of the enemies of the open society. When democratic institutions cease to function, when the consent of the governed becomes a joke, despots fill the political void. They give vent to popular anger and frustration while arming the state to do to the majority what it has long done to the minority. This tale is as old as civilization. It was played out in ancient Greece and Rome, the Soviet Union, fascist Germany, fascist Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Once a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate. It creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. Trump and his coterie of billionaires, generals, half-wits, Christian fascists, criminals, racists, and deviants play the role of the Snopes clan in some of William Faulkner's novels. The Snopeses fill the power vacuum of the decayed South and ruthlessly seized control from the degenerated former slaveholding aristocratic elites. Phlegm Snopes and his extended family, which includes a killer, a pedophile, a bigamist, an arsonist, a mentally disabled man who copulates with a cow, and a relative who sells tickets to witness the bestiality, are fictional representations of the moral rot unleashed by unfettered capitalism. The usual reference to amorality, while accurate, is not sufficiently distinctive and by itself does not allow us to place them as they should be placed in a historical moment, the critic Irving Howe wrote of the Snopeses. Perhaps the most important thing to be said is that they are what comes afterwards, the creatures that emerge from the devastation with the slime still upon their lips. Let a world collapse in the South or Russia, and there appear figures of coarse ambition driving their way up from beneath the social bottom, men to whom moral claims are not so much absurd as incomprehensible, sons of bushwhackers and musics drifting in from nowhere and taking over through the sheer outrageousness of their monolithic force. They become presidents of local banks and chairmen of party regional committees, and later, a trifle slicked up, they muscle their way into Congress or the Politburo. Scavengers without inhibition, they need not believe in the crumbling official code of their society. They need only learn to mimic its sounds. Societies that had democratic traditions are easy prey for the enemies of democracy. Demagogues pay deference to the patriotic ideals, rituals, and practices and forms of the open society while they dismantle it. When the Roman Emperor Augustus, he referred to himself as the first citizen, neutered the Republic, he was careful to maintain the form of the old Republic. Lenin and the Bolsheviks did the same when they seized and crushed the autonomous Soviets. Even the Nazis and the Stalinists insisted they ruled democratic states. Despotic government, as Thomas Paine wrote, is a fungus that grows out of a corrupt civil society. This is what happened to these older democracies. It is what happened to us. Corporations are legally empowered to exploit and loot. It is impossible to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs or ExxonMobil. The pharmaceutical and insurance industries are legally empowered to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. Banks are legally empowered to burden people with student loans that cannot be forgiven by declaring bankruptcy. The animal agriculture industry is legally empowered in many states to charge those who attempt to publicize the conditions in the vast factory farms where diseased animals are warehoused for slaughter with a criminal offense. Corporations are legally empowered to carry out tax boycotts. Free trade deals legally empower global corporations to destroy small farmers and businesses and deindustrialize the country. Government agencies designed to protect the public from contaminated air, water, and food, and from usurious creditors and lenders have been gutted. The Supreme Court, in an inversion of rights worthy of George Orwell, defines unlimited corporate contributions to electoral campaigns as the right to petition the government and a form of free speech. The press, owned by corporations, is an echo chamber for the elites. State and city enterprises and utilities are sold off to corporations that hike rates and deny services. The educational system is being privatized and turned into a species of rote vocational training. Wages are stagnant or have declined. Unemployment and underemployment, masked by falsified statistics, have thrust half the country into chronic poverty. Social services are abolished in the name of austerity. Culture and the arts have been replaced by sexual commodification, banal entertainment, and graphic depictions of violence. The infrastructure, neglected and underfunded, is collapsing. Bankruptcies, foreclosures, food shortages, and untreated illnesses that lead to early death plague a harried underclass. The desperate flee into an underground economy dominated by drugs, crime, and human trafficking. The state, rather than address the economic misery, militarizes police departments and empowers them to use lethal force against unarmed citizens. It fills the prisons with 2.3 million people, only a tiny percentage of whom ever got a trial. And 1 million prisoners now work for corporations inside prisons as modern-day slaves, paid pennies on the dollar without any rights or protection. They are the corporate state's ideal worker. The amendments of the Constitution designed to protect the citizen from tyranny are meaningless. The Fourth Amendment, for example, reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." The reality is that our telephone calls, emails, texts, and financial, judicial, and medical records, along with every website we visit, and our physical travels are tracked, recorded, and stored in perpetuity in government computer banks. The state tortures, not only in black sites, such as Bagram or Guantanamo Bay, but in supermax facilities such as the one in Florence, Colorado, where inmates suffer psychological breakdowns from prolonged solitary confinement. Prisoners endure round-the-clock electronic monitoring and 23-hour-a-day lockdowns. They undergo extreme sensory deprivation. They are beaten. They must shower and go to the bathroom on camera. They can write only one letter a week to one relative and cannot use more than three pieces of paper. They often have no access to fresh air and take their 1 hour of daily recreation in a huge cage that resembles a treadmill for hamsters. The state uses special administration measures known as SAMs to strip citizens of their judicial rights. SAMs restrict a citizen's communication with the outside world. They end calls, letters, and visits with anyone except attorneys, and sharply limit contact with family members. Citizens under SAMs are not permitted to see most of the evidence against them because of a legal provision called the Classified Information Procedures Act, or SIPA. SIPA, instituted under the Reagan administration, allows evidence in a trial to be classified. And those who are tried and convicted, like Joseph K. in Franz Kafka's The Trial, can be found guilty without ever seeing the evidence brought against them. And under SAMs, it is against the law for those who have contact with someone held under SAMs, including attorneys, to speak about the physical and psychological conditions being inflicted on the prisoner. When prisoners in our society are released, they have lost the right to vote and receive public assistance. They are burdened with fines that, if unpaid, will put them back behind bars. They are subject to arbitrary searches and arrests. They spend the rest of their lives marginalized as members of a vast criminal caste system. And that is why 76% of those released from state penitentiaries return to prison within 5 years. Our system of mass incarceration, however, is not, as critics charge, broken. It works exactly the way it is designed to work. The bodies of poor people of color do not generate money for corporations on the streets of our deindustrialized cities, but they generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year if we lock them in cages, and that is why they are there. The executive branch of government is empowered to assassinate U.S. citizens. It can call the army into the streets to quell civil unrest under Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, overturning the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the military from acting as a domestic police force. The executive branch can order the military to seize U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists or associated with terrorists, and this is called extraordinary rendition. Those seized can be denied due process and habeas corpus and held indefinitely in military facilities. Constitutionally protected statements, beliefs, and associations are now criminalized. The state can detain and prosecute people not for what they have done or even for what they are planning to do, but for holding religious or political beliefs that the state deems seditious. The first of those targeted have been observant Muslims, but they will not be the last. The outward forms of democratic participation, voting, competing political parties, judicial oversight, and legislation are meaningless theater. No one who lives under constant surveillance, who is subject to detention anywhere at any time, who has lost their legal rights, who cannot protect themselves from corporate exploitation, whose conversations, messages, meetings, proclivities, and habits are recorded, stored, and analyzed, can be described as free. The relationship between the state and the citizen who is watched constantly is one of master and slave, and the shackles will not be removed if Trump disappears. The dismantling of democratic institutions, places where the citizen has agency and a voice, is far graver than the ascendancy to the White House of Trump. The coup destroyed the two-party system. It destroyed labor unions. It destroyed public education. It destroyed the judiciary. It destroyed the press. It destroyed academia. It destroyed consumer and environmental protection. It destroyed our industrial base. It destroyed communities and cities, and it destroyed the lives of tens of millions of Americans, no longer able to find work that provides a living wage, cursed to live in chronic poverty, or locked in cages. Perhaps even more ominously, this coup destroyed the credibility of liberal democracy itself. Self-identified liberals such as the Clintons and Barack Obama mouthed the words of liberal democratic values while making war on these values in the service of corporate power, and this rendered these values meaningless. The revolt we see rippling across the country is a revolt not only against a corporate system that has betrayed workers, but also for many, the tenets that define a traditional democracy. And this is very dangerous. It will allow the radical right, with or without Trump, to cement into place an Americanized fascism. The acceleration of deindustrialization by the 1970s created a crisis that forced the ruling elites to adopt a new ideology, as Sturt Hall explains in his book, Policing the Crisis. This ideology, trumpeted by a compliant media, shifted its focus from the common good to race, crime, and law and order. It told those undergoing profound economic and political change that their suffering stemmed not from corporate greed, but from a threat to national integrity. The old consensus that buttressed the programs of the New Deal and the welfare state was discredited as enabling criminal black youth, welfare queens, and social parasites. These parasites were to blame. And this opened the door to an authoritarian populism begun by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, which supposedly championed family values, traditional morality, individual autonomy, law and order, the Christian faith, and the return of a mythical past.
Now, I don't usually break up speeches like this, but I thought, well, that actually does fit so well with some points made by Richard Wolff about what went on since the mid-1970s, because capitalism required it to go on. So, before we continue with the remainder of Chris Hedges' speech, this is a speech by Richard Wolff at the Left Forum in 2018.
I want to start by reminding you of a section of the Communist Manifesto that Karl Marx wrote 150 or whatever it is now, 170 years ago. He was stung at that time when he was writing that by an attack made against radicals, leftists, socialists. Not that many people used that language quite then. In fact, he was a bit daring even by using the word communist in the name of the manifesto he wrote. But people were attacking leftists those days on the grounds that, quote unquote, they are against the family. That if communists were in power, they would destroy the family. They are anti-family. I tell you that for two reasons. One, the sad reality that you also live in a society right now where the right wing likes to attack people like us as lacking family values. So something hasn't changed. And Marx's answer hasn't changed either. Marx's answer was, you accuse us of destroying the family? You must be kidding. We are not in the position to destroy their family. You've already done that. And what he meant was, you have put the proletarians of the world into situations where any family-type relationship is unobtainable and unsustainable. You're the perpetrator of the destruction of the family, not us. Keep in mind, though, that he had to face the fact that the people who had destroyed the family by creating economic conditions that made family unsurvivable had somehow blamed somebody else, namely them. And I'm now going to tell you a story of how pretty much the same thing is being done here and has been for 30 years, maybe 40, maybe 50. Okay. It starts here in the 1970s. This is a stylized story, so I'm not going to get all the details, but the basic story. For most of the years from 45 to 75, those 30 years after World War II, the United States economy was in a very peculiar situation. All the other capitalist countries of the world were destroyed. They couldn't compete. They couldn't produce anything. They had had a horrific war on their country, whereas we had none, excepting Pearl Harbor, and that didn't do the damage that was suffered in France or Germany or Russia or any of the other countries that we would compete with. And so it was possible for the United States to produce for everybody, and therefore to pay rising wages because they could charge whatever they needed to recoup the rising wage. For those of you who don't know, the Marshall Plan that helped Europe had a little detail in it. We're going to give you all this money, you in Europe and elsewhere, on condition that you buy American products at whatever price the American producer chose to charge. We therefore ripped the Europeans off, made a huge amount of money, and were able to tell our workers, you don't need to be left-wingers or radicals, because in the 30s they were, because we'll raise your wages without class struggle, because we don't have to pay. We have those Europeans flat on their back. The important thing is that for those 30 years, American workers could be given what they had, not quite to the same degree, but enjoyed even earlier, what came to be called a family wage. Basically enough money to allow the woman, the wife, the mother, to stay at home, raise the children. Of course, poorer people couldn't have that luxury. Non-white people particularly could not have that luxury. But a lot of white people did. And then this lovely 30-year period, 1945 to 75, came to an end. The Europeans had the bad taste to rebuild their economies. The Japanese, equally, the bad taste to rebuild their economies. And, of course, being capitalist economies, they knew who they had to beat. They had to beat the United States. They had to produce what the United States produced, either better quality or a cheaper price, or best of all, both. Otherwise, they'd have no chance. In a world dominated by the United States, militarily, politically, culturally, if you're going to succeed as a capitalist in Japan or Germany or anywhere else, you better outdo the Americans. So they set themselves to do that, and by and large, they did. So by the 1970s, Americans were trading in their Fords and Chevys and buying VWs and eventually Hondas, and you know the rest. The United States could no longer get away with the game for those first 30 years. It had to change the game. And the 1970s was the time when the game got changed. And the basic change of the game was no more wage increases. We're going to compete with these foreigners, and we're going to do it by taking it out on you, the American working class. That's always the first choice. But not just that. We're going to do a multi-pronged effort. We're going to start using technology in a way we hadn't before, replacing expensive workers, which is a double benefit because not only do you save money on the worker you replace with a machine, but you make that worker compete with the remaining workers driving down the wages. It's a nice twofer. And so they did that. And finally, when neither of those strategies were available, they went two more steps. One, they moved the jobs out of the country to where the wages were cheap, and they moved the cheap workers from whatever country they were in here to have them available here and to press down the wages, all of which worked out real well. In short, the problems of capitalist enterprises starting in the 1970s were solved by ripping off two other institutions in our society. The first one was the state. I won't go through it all with you, but you do know 1970s is when we begin to have what came to be called the tax revolt of the American people. The reality was slashing the government, Mr. Reagan is the moment when you go from government as the solution to the problems of a depressed economy that comes out of the depression into government is the problem, not the solution. And the solution is to get rid of the government, cut the taxes, cut government spending, the mantra of the Republican Party and much of the Democratic Party ever since. So the capitalists are going to solve their problem by attacking the state so they don't have to pay taxes. The culmination of that, the tax cut of last December, 2017, which caps 40 years of reducing the burden on corporations by reducing it some more. Attack the government. Immobilize the government. But I said there were two institutions. What was the other institution that the capitalists attacked in order to solve their problems? And the answer is the family. When the wages go down because you have technological change, export of job, bringing in immigrants, when you do that, it's no longer possible, particularly for the white male, keep that in your head, to have a salary that can sustain the white female at home, being the homemaker, the mother, the emotional center of the family, etc., etc. She can't do that because you can't sustain your standard of living. The thing you've promised to one another when you got married, the thing you've promised to your children, you can't afford it anymore. For those of you who don't know, the real wage that had been rising for 100 years in this country before the 1970s stopped rising. It hasn't risen since. The real wage didn't go up anymore. Meanwhile, the name of what an American dream to a family meant kept rising. No way out. So what did American families do when they couldn't do this anymore? When the capitalist system said, we're going to save the profits of business and we're going to stick it to the government and we're going to stick it to the family. Families did two things in response to this attack. They didn't want to give up the American dream. They didn't want to. They had been told that that was their birthright. That was the American experience. That was the uniqueness, the exceptionalism of America, all of that. So American families tried to hold on in this impossible situation. So they did two things. Number one, they did more hours of work. More people in the family took jobs, and if they had a job, they did a second job or more hours. And the second thing they did, because it wasn't enough to take more hours. Well, if your wages are going nowhere, but you have to spend more money, then that woman has to go out to work. No more homemaker, mother, out. If you want to call that liberation, fine. That's like when you don't eat meat anymore and you switch from hamburger to hamburger helper, and you tell yourself it's because of your diet. Doesn't mean it isn't true, but it means you're using a cover for something whose other reality you don't quite want to see. So Americans not only did more work to hold on to the American dream, but they sent the wife out. And when that wasn't enough, and it wasn't, basically because when the wife goes out to work, the family has new expenses it didn't have before. She has to have a whole other set of clothes for the job. And they maybe have to get another car in a country whose public transportation is as crappy as ours is, et cetera, et cetera. So the families did that last thing. They borrowed money like no working class has ever borrowed money before. We became pioneers, only not this time in a covered wagon going across the prairie. We became pioneers in a level of socialized consumer debt that is still the model for the world. Homeowner debt, car debt, credit card debt, and in the last 20 years, an added one, student debt. Fantastic. Load the population up. The only way you can now get that American dream is if you're working your ass off all the time and you're anxiety-ridden because of debts you know you can't pay. Of course you destroy the family. Are you kidding? Either one of those would have been enough. The combination, a knockout blow. Nobody's home enough. Everybody's catching a bit of yogurt on the way home as a substitute for a family dinner. Right? Should be familiar to all of you. The family as an institution is destroyed over the last 40 years. Think about the difference between television programs, for those of you who've had a chance to look at them, that are 40 years old. The lovely husband going out to work with the briefcase and the tie, and the lovely wife at home who's waiting for his return as she grooms Spot the dog and plays with Dick and Jane on the lawn, waiting for Daddy to come home. Isn't this charming? And the little foibles as they lead their wonderfully wonder-bred lives. Now fast forward 30 years, and what do you get? The dysfunctional family. The wife who makes jokes about the sexual inadequacy of the husband who repays her in kind. The children who roll their eyes, clearly understanding that their families, their parents, couldn't possibly have done what brought them into the world by the very nature of their awkward incompatibility. It's a cultural transformation, but it mirrors the economic reality. The family is done. Many of you are the products of these families. I don't want to upset you, but you already know that. As Harriet Fraud will tell you, the signs of it in people's decisions about whether or not to get married, whether or not to have children, it's already there. You already know it. You already know it. So let me conclude by telling you what the consequences are of the destruction of the family because it was needed by a capitalist system at a certain time to solve its problems that way. First, there was a genius appropriation of this process by the Republican Party in the United States and the complete missing of what's going on by the Democratic Party, which, if you follow politics, shouldn't surprise you. This is a repetition over and over again, right up to the present. Here's what the Republican Party understood. Having helped the capitalists more than the Democrats to carry through all of these steps, cutting the taxes of the governments, making the government smaller, weakening the unions, opening the globe for American expansion, all the things Republicans do more than Democrats, and having thereby smashed the family, the Republican Party realized that the way to save this situation for themselves was to position themselves as the champion of family values. That's genius. You destroy an institution, throw people into the horror of living out the destruction of what they had been led to expect, and then you say, vote for us, we'll bring it all back. The Democrats, moving with real skill into the level of complete stupidity, didn't see any of it. Didn't understand, what's this family values, hypocritically, missed the whole thing. They thereby got the mass of people suffering what it means to have no family in a very rapacious capitalist universe where you have to work longer hours and you're tired and the family might have been that haven in a heartless world that Marx once referred to it as. Couldn't function that way. Well, people were distraught. And the Republicans came along and said, yes, the family is under attack and it's... What? They're not going to say it's the capitalists. That's them. So who is it? It's homosexuals. It's homosexuals. And anybody else they could think of other than the capitalist system. Anybody. Democrats, in fact, could be pointed out. So you turn the destruction of the family not into not only an asset for Republicans, but a loss for the Democrats. Without that move, the Republicans would not have been able to have power in the last 35 years of American society. No Trump, no Bush, none of it. That or Reagan. This is a linchpin. That's why this is so important to understand, of American politics. Last point. There's a Achilles heel of all of this for the Republicans, and I don't want to leave you without making that clear. This embrace of family values has now been split inside the Republican conservative world. It's been split because a subpart of that world wants this to be the celebration not of all family values, but of white people's family values. And by white people's family values, they actually mean white male people's family values. That is, they want the party to become the party of reconstructing the time when, whether it's real or fantasy is really not the point here, but to reconstruct an America in which white men have their white wife back with Dick, Jane, and Spot so that they can come home from their insecure 80-hour-a-week job to enjoy what's left of the lawn in our ecologically mangled culture. But it's a serious image. They're going to bring it back. They have to argue that they're going to bring it back. And therein lies something which, if we're lucky, will be a fatal flaw. Because they can't. They're not bringing it back. Not because they wouldn't like to in some fantastic way, but because they cannot. And it is extremely dangerous to sell yourself to the mass of the American people as the deliverer of a package that never comes. You know how you feel about UPS and Amazon when it never comes after you've paid. Why can't it come? Because nothing is stopping the capitalists from their appointed rounds. They're moving jobs out of the country. They're bringing cheap labor in. All the noise about immigrants is undone as fast as it's passed. It's all political theater. If you pay attention, immigrants are being brought in because the farms can't run without them, because the hospitals need them for the work that's underpaid, all of the other things that Americans can't do, or if you have Americans doing, which is much more important, they will be so angry and bitter that it's more dangerous for capitalism than to bring the damn immigrants back and live with the tensions that that involves. You can't bring it back. You can't deliver. The jobs aren't there, the incomes aren't there, and the capitalists are not playing in this game, which means the Republicans are working against the clock. They're promising they cannot deliver. Sooner or later, that blows up. And the only real question is whether the left, inside or outside the Democratic Party, assuming that inside they're still there, the question is whether we have the analytic and the organization to expose this story and to offer a whole new way of organizing society that can actually make emotional, personal, intimate, sexual relations among people a priority that the society respects and supports, rather than something thrown away when the difficulties of profitability lead corporations to do all that and let the chips fall where they may. Capitalism destroyed the family. And if that's a problem for you, which it is, then your anger and your hostility ought to go to where the problem starts. And it's not homosexuals. Thank you.
Now, we continue with the second half of Chris Hedges' speech.
It turns out, 45 years later, that those who truly hate us for our freedoms are not the array of dehumanized enemies cooked up by the war machine, the Vietnamese, Cambodians, Afghans, Iraqis, Iranians, even the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS. They are the financiers, bankers, politicians, public intellectuals, and pundits, lawyers, journalists, and business people cultivated in the elite universities and business schools who sold us the utopian dream of neoliberalism. We are entering the twilight phase of capitalism. Capitalists unable to generate profits by expanding markets has, as Karl Marx predicted, begun to cannibalize the state like ravenous parasites. Wealth is no longer created by producing or manufacturing. It is created by manipulating the prices of stocks and commodities and imposing a crippling debt peonage on the public. This casino capitalism is designed to prey on the desperate, young men and women burdened by student loans, underpaid workers burdened by credit card debt and mortgages, towns and cities forced to borrow to maintain municipal services. This seminal moment in human history marks the end of a long, tragic tale of plunder and murder by the white race. It is inevitable that for the final act, we vomited up Trump. Europeans and Americans have spent five centuries conquering, plundering, exploiting, and polluting the earth in the name of civilization and human progress. They use their technological superiority to create the most efficient killing machines on the planet, directed against anyone or anything, especially indigenous cultures, which stood in their way. They stole and hoarded the planet's wealth and resources. They believe this orgy of blood and gold will never end. They do not understand that the dark ethic of ceaseless capitalism and imperialist expansion is over, and that it is dooming the exploiters as well as the exploited. But even as we stand on the cusp of extinction, we lack the ability to free ourselves from the myth of human progress. Walter Benjamin wrote in 1940, amid the rise of European fascism and looming world war, this. A Klee painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring. His mouth is open. His wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe, which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm irresistibly propels him into the future to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. The more the warning signs are palpable, rising temperatures, global financial meltdowns, mass migrations, endless wars, poisoned ecosystems, rampant corruption among the ruling elites, the more we turn to those who insist that what worked in the past will work in the future, that progress is inevitable. Factual evidence, since it is an impediment to what we desire, is banished. The taxes of corporations and the rich, who have turned most of our cities into wastelands, are cut. Regulations and laws are rescinded. To bring back the supposed golden era of the 1950s for white American workers. Public lands are opened up to the oil and gas industry, even as rising carbon emissions doom our species. Declining crop yields stemming from heat waves and droughts are ignored. War becomes the principal business of the kleptocratic state. Magical thinking is not limited to the beliefs and practices of pre-modern cultures. It defines the ideology of capitalism. Quotas and projected sales can always be met. Profits can always be raised. Growth is inevitable. The impossible is always possible. Human societies, if they bow before the dictates of the marketplace, will be ushered into a capitalist paradise. It is only a question of having the right attitude and the right technique. When capitalism thrives, we are assured we thrive. The merging of the self with the capitalist collective has robbed us of our agency, creativity, capacity for self-reflection, and moral autonomy. We define our worth not by our independence or our character, but by the material standards set by capitalism: wealth, brands, status, career advancement. We have been molded into a compliant and repressed collective. This conformity is characteristic of totalitarian and authoritarian states. It is expressed in the Disneyfication of America, the land of eternally happy thoughts and positive attitudes. And when magical thinking does not work, we are told and often accept that we are the problem. We must have more faith. We must envision what we want. We must try harder. The system is never to blame. We failed it. It does not fail us. And all our systems of information, from self-help gurus to Hollywood, to charlatans such as Trump, sell us this snake oil. What does resistance look like now? It will not come by investing hope in the Democratic Party, which did not lose the elections because of Comey or the Russians, but because it betrayed working men and women on behalf of corporate power and used its machinery to deny the one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who could have defeated Trump, from getting the nomination. The proposed cuts, $9.2 billion from the Department of Education, $616 billion from Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program over 10 years, $200 billion from the food stamp program, a lifeline for 44 million people, $72 billion for people with disabilities, $39 billion for subsidized student loans, and $859 million for public service loan forgiveness, along with a $500 billion increase to the Pentagon's budget over the next decade, accelerates the austerity programs and militarism that has been embraced by the Democratic Party. As Diane Ravitch pointed out, for example, the Democrats bear as much responsibility for Betsy DeVos as the Republicans. DeVos's proposed voucher system, allowing parents to use public funding for private and religious schools, is modeled on a school choice program introduced by then Governor Bill Clinton. This voucher system was promoted by Obama and Arne Duncan. Obama closed countless public schools. He doubled the number of students attending charter schools. And it was Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party who gave us NAFTA, the destruction of welfare, the deregulation of the FCC, the explosion of our prison population, and the abolishment of Glass-Steagall that precipitated the global financial meltdown. Yes! Resistance will entail a personal commitment to refuse to cooperate in large and small ways with the machinery of corporate power, especially the fossil fuel industry. After all, the only safe figure for carbon emissions is zero. This will require us, as Ralph Nader has long said, to show up. We have to, as Max Weber advised, make politics a vocation. And resistance will begin locally as we transform our neighborhoods and our communities. In the conflicts I covered as a reporter in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans, I encountered singular individuals of varying creeds, religions, races, and nationalities who majestically rose up to defy the oppressor on behalf of the oppressed. Some of them are dead. Some of them are forgotten. Most of them are unknown. These individuals, despite their vast cultural differences, had common traits: a profound commitment to the truth, incorruptibility, courage, a distrust of power, a hatred of violence, and a deep empathy that was extended to people who were different from them, even to people defined by the dominant culture as the enemy. They are the most remarkable men and women I met in my 20 years as a foreign correspondent, and to this day I set my life by the standards they set. You have heard of some, such as Václav Havel, whom I and other foreign reporters met most evenings during the Velvet Revolution in Prague in 1989 at the Magic Lantern Theater. Others, no less great, you may not know, such as the Jesuit priest Ignacio Ellacuría, who was assassinated in El Salvador in 1989. And then, there are those ordinary people, although, as the writer V.S. Pritchett said, no people are ordinary, who risk their lives in wartime to shelter and protect those of an opposing religion or ethnicity who were being persecuted and hunted. And to some of these ordinary people, I owe my life. To resist radical evil is to endure a life that, by the standards of the wider society, is a failure. It is to defy injustice at the cost of your career, your reputation, your financial solvency, and at times your life. It is to be a lifelong heretic. And perhaps this is the most important point. It is to accept that the dominant culture, and perhaps, and maybe even especially, the liberal elites will push you to the margins and attempt to discredit not only what you do, but your character. When I returned to the newsroom at the New York Times in 2003, after denouncing the invasion of Iraq and being publicly reprimanded for my stance against the war, reporters and editors I had known and worked with for 15 years lowered their heads or turned away when I was nearby. Ruling institutions, the state, the press, the church, the courts, academia, mouth the language of morality, but they serve the structures of power, no matter how venal, which provide them with money, status, and authority. In times of national distress, one has only to look at Nazi Germany. All these institutions, including the academy, are complicit through their silence or their active collaboration with radical evil. And our institutions are no different. The lonely individuals who defy tyrannical power within these institutions, as we saw with the thousands of academics who were fired from their jobs and blacklisted during the McCarthy era, are usually purged and turned into pariahs. All institutions, including the church, Paul Tillich once wrote, are inherently demonic. And a life dedicated to resistance has to accept that a relationship with any institution is usually temporary, because sooner or later that institution is going to demand acts of silence or obedience your conscience will not allow you to make. To be a rebel is to reject the capitalist mantra that I come first. The theologian James Cone, in his book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, writes that for oppressed blacks, the cross was a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system. With the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, that the last shall be first and the first last. Cone continues that God could make a way out of no way in Jesus' cross was truly absurd to the intellect, yet profoundly real in the souls of black folk. Enslaved blacks who first heard the gospel message seized on the power of the cross. Christ crucified manifested God's loving and liberating presence in the contradictions of black life. That transcendent presence in the lives of black Christians that empowered them to believe that ultimately, in God's eschatological future, they would not be defeated by the troubles of this world, no matter how great and painful their suffering. Believing this paradox, this absurd claim of faith, was only possible in humility and repentance. There was no place for the proud and the mighty, for people who think that God called them to rule over others. The cross was God's critique of power, white power, with powerless love, snatching victory out of defeat. Reinhold Niebuhr labeled this capacity to defy the forces of repression a sublime madness in the soul. Niebuhr wrote that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is dangerous, but it is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism was a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr said, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible had this sublime madness. The words of the prophets, as Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. The prophet, because he or she saw and faced an unpleasant reality, was, as Heschel wrote, compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his or her heart expected. This sublime madness is the essential quality for a life of resistance. It is the acceptance that although empirically all that we struggle to achieve during our lifetime may be worse, our struggle validates itself. Daniel Berrigan once told me that faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call this karma. But he said for us, we did not know where it goes. We trust that it goes somewhere. We do not know where. But we are called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then let it go. As Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the only morally reliable people are not those who say this is wrong or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. They know that, as Immanuel Kant wrote, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this means that, like Socrates, we must come to a place where it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. We must at once see and act. And given what it means to see, this will require the surmounting of despair, not by reason, but by faith. I saw in the conflicts I covered the power of this faith, which lies outside of any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Havel called in his essay, The Power of the Powerless, living in truth. Living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade, and it has a cost. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Havel wrote. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He or she is not seeking power. He or she has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He or she does not attempt to charm the public. He or she offers nothing and promises nothing. He or she can offer, if anything, only their own skin. And they offer it solely because they have no other way of affirming the truth they stand for. Their actions simply articulate their dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The long, long road of sacrifice and defiance that led to the collapse of the communist regime stretched back decades. Those who made change possible were those who had discarded all notions of the practical. They did not try to reform the Communist Party. They did not attempt to work within the system. They did not even know what, if anything, their tiny protests, ignored by the state-controlled media, would accomplish. But through it all, they held fast to moral imperatives. They did so because these values were right and just. They expected no reward for their virtue. Indeed, they got none. They were marginalized and persecuted. And yet, these rebels, poets, playwrights, actors, singers, and writers ultimately triumphed over state and military power. They drew the good to the good. They triumphed because, however cowed and broken, the people around them appeared. Their message did not go unheard. It did not go unseen. The steady drumbeat of rebellion exposes the dead hand of authority and the rot of the state. I stood with hundreds of thousands of Czechs in 1989 on a cold winter night in Prague's Venceslas Square. as the singer Marta Kubishova approached the balcony of the Milantrik building. Kubishova had been banished from the airwaves in 1968 after the Soviet invasion for her anthem of defiance, A Prayer for Marta. Her entire catalog, including more than 200 singles, had been confiscated and destroyed. She had disappeared from public view. Her voice that night suddenly flooded the square. Pressing around me were throngs of students, most of whom had not been born when she vanished from public view. They began to sing the words of the anthem. There were tears running down their faces. It was then that I understood the power of resistance. It was then that I knew that no act of rebellion, however futile it appears in the moment, is wasted. And it was then that I knew that the communist regime was finished. The walls of Prague were covered that winter with posters of Jan Palach. Palach, a university student, set himself on fire in Wenceslas Square on January 16, 1969, in the middle of the day, to protest the crushing of the country's democracy movement. He died of his burns 3 days later. The state swiftly attempted to erase his act from national memory. There was no mention of it on the state media. A funeral march by university students was broken up by the police. Palach's gravesite, which became a shrine, saw the communist authorities exhume his body, cremate his remains, and ship them to his mother with a provision that his ashes could not be placed in a cemetery. But it did not work. His sacrifice spurred the students in the winter of 1989 to act. Prague's Red Army Square, shortly after I left for Bucharest to cover the uprising in Romania, was renamed Palach Square, and 10,000 people were at the dedication. We may feel powerless, but we are not. We have a power that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements to follow. It passes on another narrative. And it will, as the state consumes itself, attract wider and wider numbers. Perhaps this will not happen in our lifetimes, but if we persist, we keep this possibility alive, and if we do not, it will die. Dr. Rio and Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, is not driven to act by ideology. He is driven by empathy, the duty to minister to the suffering of others, no matter the cost. To act on this empathy, the empathy for human beings locked in cages, the empathy for undocumented mothers and fathers being torn from their children on the streets of our cities, the empathy for Muslims who are demonized and banned from our shores, fleeing the wars and terror we created, the empathy for poor people of color gunned down by police in our streets, the empathy for girls and women trafficked into prostitution, the empathy for our great and glorious earth, which gives us life and which is being destroyed, is not only viewed by despots as political, but seditious. A life of faith, and we are all called to faith, is a life of confrontation. As Flannery O'Connor writes of St. Cyril of Jerusalem and instructing catechumens, the dragon sits by the side of the road, watching those who pass. Beware, lest he devour you. We go to the Father of souls, but it is necessary to pass by the dragon. No matter what form the dragon may take, it is of this mysterious passage past him or into his jaws that stories of any depth will always be concerned to tell. And this being the case, it requires considerable courage at any time in any country not to turn away from the storyteller. Accept sorrow, for who cannot be profoundly sorrowful at the state of our nation, the world, what we are doing to our planet? But know that in resistance there is a balm that leads to wisdom, and if not joy, a strange, transcendent happiness. Know that as long as we resist, we keep hope alive. My faith has been tempered in hell, wrote Vasily Grossman in Life and Faith, Fate. My faith has emerged from the flames of the crematoria, from the concrete of the gas chamber. I have seen that it is not man who is impotent in the struggle against evil, but the power of evil that is impotent in the struggle against man. The powerlessness of kindness, of senseless kindness, is the secret of its immortality. It can never be conquered. The more stupid, the more senseless, the more helpless it may seem, the vaster it is. Evil is impotent before it. The prophets, religious leaders, reformers, social and political leaders are impotent before it. This dumb, blind love is man's meaning. Human history is not the battle of good struggling to overcome evil. It is the battle fought by a great evil, struggling to crush a small kernel of human kindness. But if what is human in human beings has not been destroyed even now, then evil will never conquer. The days ahead will be dark and frightening. But we must fight for the sacred. We must fight for life. We must fight the forces of death. We fight not only for ourselves, but for those who will come after us, our children. Revolt is a political necessity. It is a moral imperative. We must not be complicit. We must live in truth. The moment we defy power in any form, we are victorious. The moment we stand with the oppressed and accept being treated like the oppressed, we are victorious. The moment we hold up a flickering light in the darkness for others to see, we are victorious. The moment we thwart the building of a pipeline or a fracking site, we are victorious. The moment we keep a mother faced with deportation with her children, we are victorious. The moment we mass in the streets to defy police violence, we are victorious. We must turn the tide of fear. We must, by taking the streets, make the ruling elites frightened of us. To sit idle, to refuse to defy these forces, to by our silence be complicit, will atrophy and wither our souls. It will leave us husks of human beings. This is not only a fight for life. It is a fight that gives life. It is the supreme expression of faith. It is the belief that no matter how great is the power of evil, the power of love is greater. I do not, in the end, fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Theme tune, The Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I've got so much to say on this topic, but don't get me started. I'm just finishing. You're still working within the 2-hour-per-show limit. Perhaps I'll make another one next week. And if you'd like to suggest material for the show, you can email me, robin-upton@robinupton.com.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
Renegade Economists: How to Resist the Demands of Permanent Economic Growth and Protect the Earth, Indigenous Communities, Local Agriculture, and Women. Kate Raworth. Why It's Time for a New Version of Human Prosperity. Kate Raworth came to international attention in 2017 with the publication of her most recent book, Donut Economics: 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She critiques the gross domestic product system of accounting, including the so-called green or sustainable growth models. As you listen to her talk to health professionals in London in December 2016, imagine 2 circles, one inside the other, forming a hole in the middle. That's the donut. Based on the work of Earth system scientists, Kate Raworth graphs 9 planetary boundaries into the outer ring. They spell danger when crossed. Among them are climate change, ocean acidification, water depletion, chemical pollution, etc. The problem is that we already overshot the limits of at least 4 of the 9 boundaries. Inside the smaller circle, in what we call the donut hole, she places a graphic representation of people without health care, food, water, education, a job, access to energy, and more. In Kate Raworth's donut model, the goal is to raise the well-being of humans trapped inside the donut hole while placing limits on climate change and pollution that are near or have crossed the outer circle of the donut. Kate Raworth is teaching at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Over the last 2 decades, she has worked as senior researcher at Oxfam and as co-author of the United Nations Human Development Report. In this talk, she refers to her co-presenter, Kevin. That's Kevin Anderson. He's a frequent guest on TUC Radio. And she offers an apology to the audience. Here's Kate Raworth.
I know it's early in the day, and I apologise for bringing junk food into the room already, especially to health professionals. I've had so many medics and doctors write to me saying, I love your concept, but did you have to call it a donut? Do you know how unhealthy these are? So all I can say is perhaps I'm going to introduce you to the one donut that might actually turn out to be good for us, and I hope I can explain why. So in the 20th century, the shape of progress was very simple. It was this ever-rising line measured in GDP growth. It's the dominant paradigm, the dominant metric. We hear it in our politicians' language every day. The trouble is, it brought two things uncomfortably with it. It's brought extraordinary inequality. Now just 62 billionaires own the same wealth as the poorest half of the world's population and sail around in these very high-carbon ships. And at the same time, it's brought extraordinary degradation, which Kevin has just spoken so eloquently and passionately about. And this is a very uncomfortable problem to have when you live by a growth paradigm. So what can our politicians do with that? It's clear that they are searching for a better language to describe what progress looks like while they're still wedded to growth. And I call it playing growth bingo. So I listen every time I hear a politician talking about growth. What word do they stick in front of it? So Angela Merkel has talked about sustained growth. Barack Obama wants long-term lasting growth. David Cameron called for balanced growth. But you can have it good, you can have it green, smart, smarter growth, equitable, inclusive growth, anything you like, just so long as it's growth. Of course, some of these politicians have already gone. And so I've been listening carefully to what those coming say. Theresa May just talks about economic growth. She says she wants Britain to be the greatest meritocracy in the world. But when she talks about economic growth, she doesn't add any word in front of it. I'm still trying to figure out what she's doing with this concept. But Donald Trump, he's very clear. He's stripped away all these nice adjectives. He's just pro-growth. And that's alarming because it means we're going back, we're going away from the nuance, we're going away from the change. So when it comes to change, I'm extremely inspired by the extraordinary American inventor, Buckminster Fuller, and his wise words. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And so in that spirit, I don't want to stick adjectives in front of growth and try and amend it, appease it, or make it more palatable. I want to come up with a completely new model. And it turns out that that model looks rather like a donut. So let me tell you what this donut is. On the outside of it, the outer ring of the donut, is, let's say, an environmental ceiling of pressure that we can put on the planet's boundaries before we tip this extraordinary, fragile, living Earth on which we depend out of the benevolent state it's been in for the last 11,700 years that's been so incredibly generous to humanity that we've managed to thrive. In 2009, a group of leading Earth system scientists got together and said, what is it about the last 11,700 years, it's been an extraordinarily stable phase of planet Earth's history. How can we understand what those are? And to me, these people are like planetary doctors. Medics have spent hundreds of years examining many, many, many individual human beings and learned the parameters of the human body, and that's what we call modern medicine. It's why so many of us survive. My children, I have 8-year-old twins, and when they were very little, I knew that if their temperature went above 38 or 39 degrees, I had to completely focus on bringing it back down because we call that a fever. It's too high, and it must come back down. So we know the parameters of pressure that we can put on the human body. Well, I think of today's Earth system scientists as planetary doctors for the 21st century. But instead of hundreds of years of practice and knowledge, it's been going for about 30 years, so it's incredibly new science. And there's only one planetary body on which to experiment and explore. So it's a much trickier challenge to understand the health of our planetary body. But it's the very same questions. How many different systems are interacting? What's the equivalent of the planet's respiratory system, nervous system, muscular system, skeletal system? And how much pressure can we put on any one of those systems before we kick it out of balance and tip Earth from this benevolent phase of life into ill health for humanity for sure? And they said they believe there are 9 key Earth system processes that we have to stay within to keep ourselves within these 9 planetary boundaries. So Kevin has talked a lot about the top one there, climate change, ensuring we don't put so many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that we cause the Earth's temperature to rise with so many extraordinarily damaging impacts. But there are others. We mustn't withdraw so much water from Earth's freshwater systems that we actually transform the hydrological cycle and stop the flow of rivers. That we mustn't put so much nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer into cropland that leaches out. It doesn't get taken up by crops. It leaches out into to the sea and lake bodies, and it causes eutrophication, changing those bodies green, absorbing all the oxygen and killing off aquatic life. Other ones include ocean acidification. So much carbon dioxide gets dissolved in oceans that it acidifies the water, killing off sea life. Chemical pollution, whether the chemical is plastic or persistent organic pollution or chemical waste or all sorts of products that humankind, these novel entities that we create, we don't yet fully understand how they interact with the fabric of life and change, even at the DNA level, change life forms. We mustn't put so many atmospheric aerosols, little tiny particulates up in the air that we see as smoke or smog. They cause smog for human health, but also they can change where the monsoon occurs. They move the monsoon patterns across countries. The ozone hole, the release of CFC gases opened up this great big hole in the ozone layer, and we know that we must then close that because the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet light that causes skin cancer and damages so many living organisms. Biodiversity loss. If we transform the surface of Earth's land and reduce biodiversity, we not only lose an extraordinary range of living organisms, but we also create monoculture and lose the resilience that is embedded within diversity. And the lastly one on land use change. If we transform the natural state of land's Earth's surface and turn it into farmland and cities and highways, again, we're reducing Earth's capacity to absorb carbon dioxide, for sure, but also the resilience of diverse landforms. So the Earth system scientists said, we think these are the 9 planetary boundaries that we have to keep an eye on to stay within safe levels of pressure on each of them, because they're all interdependent. And if we push ourselves over these risk boundaries, we really risk kicking Earth out of the safe space that's been a human home for over 10,000 years. So where are we on those planetary boundaries? They plotted them on a chart, and you can see we're well over the climate change boundary. We're way over on the nitrogen boundary and way over on the biodiversity loss boundary. In fact, they've updated this science, and they say we're also far over on the land use change boundary and on the phosphorus boundary. So we are already over at least 4 of the boundaries. They haven't yet managed to quantify aerosol loading and chemical pollution, so we could be over on those as well. We don't know. They are huge unknowns. But we are already way over planetary boundaries. But is the answer to come right back within planetary boundaries as if we were putting no pressure on the planet? Is the answer to use no fertilizer at all, to withdraw no water from Earth's rivers and lakes? Is the answer to transform none of the Earth's land surface? No, because that would be death and disease and destruction for many millions of human beings. We have to engage with Earth's resources to provide for our own needs. So when I saw this diagram of the 9 planetary boundaries and drawn as a circle, and I was sitting in Oxfam, and some of my colleagues over there were responding to food crisis in the Sahel, and others were campaigning for health and education for all worldwide, I thought, if there are outer limits of pressure beyond which lie unacceptable environmental degradation, then so too there are inner limits of resource use and pressure, below which lie shortfalls in human well-being or human deprivation. So in that blue circle lies human deprivation in terms of the most basic needs of our lives, whether it's healthcare, food, water, education, basic income, having a job, having a voice in society, being resilient, having access to energy, and having these things with social equity and gender equality. And I crowdsourced these from the world's governments in the run-up to the Rio Plus 20 conference. So these were the 11 top priorities of more than half the world's governments, the social priorities that they saw, and most of them, in fact, all of them, have been since embedded in the Sustainable Development Goals. Where are we on those social foundations? Well, if every human being in the world had the resources to meet their human rights, that entire inner circle would go orange. But you can see there's these blue areas of deprivation remaining. So, for example, on food, 13% of people don't have enough food to eat. For income, 21% of people live on less than $1.25 a day. So now what happens when we put these together? We've entered the 21st century already having exceeded 3, even 4 planetary boundaries. We have gone into a risk zone where we risk tipping Earth out of the stable home that it's been for us for centuries, for millennia. And yet many millions of people worldwide still cannot meet their very most basic needs. To me, this is the extraordinary indictment of the path of economic development that has been pursued over the last, and asking us, can we actually come back into this donut-shaped space, ending human deprivation and environmental degradation at the same time? And to me, this is the generational challenge. Fiona said, can we balance hope and despair? We can be desperate when we look at the extraordinary overshoot and shortfall. And we can be hopeful when we see a positive vision of a world we want to inhabit. What if we could be the generation, because as Kevin says, we have to be the generation that begins to turn this situation around, that actually starts putting humanity on track for being within the donut rather than pushing ourselves further outside of its safe and just space. So what if each of us put our own lives on a little donut-shaped table and asked ourselves, how does the way that I live impact on humanity's ability to come within this safe and just space between social and planetary boundaries? How does the way that I eat, travel, shop, bank, vote, volunteer, demonstrate, help my neighbours, how do all these ways that I live impact on social and planetary boundaries? What if every company in the world actually drew up its corporate strategy at this donut-shaped table and asked itself, is the way that we're producing product actually undermining people's human rights and pushing the planet over planetary boundaries? Or can we transform who we are as a business and what we produce and how we produce it and what we stand for so that the core practice of our business is actually helping to bring humanity into this safe and just space? There are companies today that are taking on that challenge and trying to transform their business. What if you were sitting around this table as a set of healthcare professionals asking yourselves, how could we create a healthcare system that brings humanity into this space that meets the health needs, but also the rights, the voice, the resilience, the gender equity, the social equity needs of everybody within social and planetary boundaries? What kind of healthcare system would do that? What if every urban designer, every planner building the cities of the future, because there are going to be many more, had a donut-shaped diagram on the table as a compass, as a vision for the city they wanted to build? Well, I know that sounds ridiculous. The interesting thing is that there are people doing this right now. I was contacted by a group of urban planners in Kokstad, which is the fastest-growing town in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And they said, we love this donut diagram. We took it in 2012. The municipality of our town worked together with the local youth, and we drew up a vision for our town, for what we want, for how it's going to provide for everybody's needs within planetary boundaries. And the best thing that they did, under the social foundation, they added one extra dimension, which was fun. They said, we're going to live within social planetary boundaries. We're going to have fun while we do it. So there's the hope. But also, it's not just happening in South Africa. In Sweden, some designers contacted me, and they're designing and building a new suburb of Stockholm, about 15 minutes by train, called Kimlinge. And they said, we love this donut, and we are setting out to design the most sustainable city districts in the world. We want Kimlinge to be the first one, but we want to replicate this worldwide. So again, taking a positive vision of social and planetary integrity and saying, how can we redesign the world around this? So there's a vision, but what would it actually take to bring ourselves into this space? For me, one of the key questions we need to be asking, Kevin started asking it this morning, what key factors shape humanity's ability to move into this safe and just space? Six of them come up time and time and time again, so I'm just going to talk briefly about six of these issues. Population, inequality, aspiration, education, governance, and technology. So I'm going to start in a place that people are often afraid to talk about, with population. Because population does matter. It really matters how many of us there are. If we want to meet the human rights of all people in the world, we need to care about the number of us in total, because the more of us there are in total, the more that the requirements for meeting that social foundation are going to increase. The thing about population is it's not the one that keeps me awake at night, you see, because in the early 1970s, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, and population was this great scare story, as if this is the population growth curve, exponentially growing, and it looked like it was exponentially growing in the early 1970s. But actually, what population is doing is quite the opposite. It's plateauing, right? A very subtle difference of the arm from the exponential growth curve to a plateau. It's gone through an exponential phase, but it's plateauing off. And the great thing about population growth is we know how to slow down the growth rate of the human population. I'm sure all of you know, because it's got a lot to do with medicine. It's about child health, women's reproductive rights, girls' education, and women's empowerment. And these things are a magic list of factors that if you empower women and provide decent health care, women are empowered to take control of the size of their own families. And this is how we slow down and stabilize the growth rate and stabilize the size of the global population. So this is not the one that keeps me awake at night, because there are other things like GDP growth that are still on the exponential curve, and we haven't figured out how to make them plateau. What about inequality? I mentioned that 13% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. How much would it actually require to give them enough food to eat? It would take 3% of today's global food supply to ensure that everybody had enough food to eat. And that is in light, right? 3%? Well, right now, 30 to 50% of food is lost post-harvest, wasted in the supply chain, or scraped off plates in the kitchen. So we're looking for 10% of what's not even being eaten at the moment. This is one measure of the scale of extraordinary inequality that there is in the world, not just in terms of income, but access to the most basic of resources of food. Kevin already mentioned that 45% of the world's carbon emissions are produced in the name of just 10% of people. I call them the global carbonistas, and we know we're part of it. Many of us are part of the global carbonistas, living on every continent with a high carbon lifestyle. But also, one-third of the world's sustainable nitrogen budget. So if we brought nitrogen use back within what's seen as a sustainable level by planetary boundary scientists, one-third of that is used to produce meat and dairy for the EU. So kudos to the woman who wanted vegetables, to the man who said beefless diet, and the person over here called for allotments. The way we eat and the way we eat in high-income countries has a huge impact on global carbon emissions. So aspiration, I'm going to move on, for I've done population and inequality. Aspiration. We have lived through a century that has encouraged consumerism and selfish individualism. It's the PR industry. It's the advertising industry. It's the engine of consumerism that sends us out every Easter and Halloween, and here we go Christmas, and then it'll be Valentine's Day, and then it'll be, you know, coming around. All these holidays we're encouraged to go out. Black Friday taking root in this country. Why are we taught to find status in what we buy and what we own? And we need to transform that to finding meaning in community, in experience, and relationships. And that experience, of course, is a picture of people hiking up a mountain. Of course, it also matters how you get there. So you can't fly in a high-carbon flight to go and have a wonderful natural experience. We need to be consistent in the whole vision of what we're doing. But transforming those aspirations, whether it's for love or for bringing care back in, this is a profound transformation. And we have been put through this century of consumerism. And, you know, step out into London, it's all around you. Advertising is everywhere. How on earth are we going to undo the lock-in, the economic lock-in of advertising and consumerism? Technology. There are many, many different technologies you could use. So on the top here, I've got pictures of different suggestions that people have used for combating climate change. You could stick mirrors in space and reflect the sunlight back, or you could stick solar panels on the roof of your house. How about supplying enough food for the world? You could encourage community gardens and enable small groups of farmers to save their own seeds and grow their own food. Or you could grow high-tech, biotech food in scientifically controlled laboratories and own seed by corporate owned. All of these are possible solutions, but they have very, very different impacts, both on planetary boundaries and on social outcomes, social distribution and social justice in terms of voice control of technology. So they have multiple impacts. And often one of the reasons for looking at 9 planetary boundaries together is because sometimes people come up with solutions for climate change, which will actually aggravate problems of biodiversity loss or problems of food shortage, as Kevin was talking about, looking at in terms of the use of biomass as a means of creating a low-carbon society. All sorts of other ramifications. You cannot look at climate change in isolation from the rest of it, from the social story and the other planetary boundaries. And let's remember that behind these choices are many, many companies, whether they're fossil fuel companies, car companies, high-tech companies, food companies, with huge lobby power and lobby interest in terms of which technology is chosen. So these technologies are not being chosen in a vacuum or in terms of a calm, rational policy decision-making choice. It is strongly influenced by vested interests. Which brings me on to governance. Whether it's teamwork or collaboration, governance matters from the very local to the global. And I've just brought here one example of global governance. If we could see that picture of the planet as a video, you'd see the clouds moving continually, shifting between and over continents. They don't recognize national borders. But as humans, we have divided ourselves into these little plots of land from Afghanistan at the beginning to Zimbabwe at the end and many, many in between that we call countries. And then we come together, whether it's at the United Nations or the Paris Agreement, and so often negotiate from short-term national self-interest and find it so hard to rise above that and seek long-term common collective global human interest for future generations as well as today's. And that's just the global governance story. And we've seen the problems of that played out over more than 20 years, resulting in the Paris Agreement, which is deeply inadequate. But there's even an agreement there. Many of the other planetary boundaries don't even have an agreement process going on. So from the local, the way you relate to your neighbours across the garden fence, that's part of governance as well. And if we can't do it with our own neighbours across our garden fences, how can we expect the United Nations to do it? So we have to transform the way we govern ourselves from the very, very local to the global. And that brings me lastly to education, and it's one I'm passionate about, particularly about economic education, but all kinds of education. We need to transform the paradigms that we're using to understand the world. So if anyone here has been to an economics lecture, let's imagine if this was an economics lecture. Anybody, what was the first diagram that you would learn in economics? Shout it out. Supply and demand, there you go, you learn the supply and demand curves, right? The little crisscross of the supply and demand lines. It's magic. Kevin had a lovely picture of a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. To me, this is economists pulling a rabbit out of a hat, because the first diagram you learn, before anyone even mentioned it, the economy apparently is the market. That is what the economy is, and it's about supply and demand. And apparently the market and prices pull the economy into equilibrium. Well, the equilibrium is just not true at all. The economy does not exist in equilibrium. It's a complex, ever-evolving, shifting system. It's not mechanical. But the economy is not just the market. There's the household economy. All of us came from household economies this morning, and anybody who got kids up today definitely came from a household economy, of raising the next generation, feeding, cleaning, washing the dishes. It's reproducing ourselves as labour in the economy. But there's also the role of the state, and there's the role of the commons. So there are many forms of economy, and mainstream economics just takes us straight into the market as if that's all there is. We have to deeply enrichen our understanding of what the economy is and what it's for and who we are in it and how it moves. So I wish the first economics lecture didn't begin with supply and demand. I wish it began with the donut and the question, what kind of economy would bring humanity into this space? And that would be a completely different economics degree. And that's from my passion of reinventing education. This is where my passion lies. So I left my job at Oxfam because I wanted to pursue this even more deeply. And I've just spent the last 2 years writing a book. It's called Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. I used to be ashamed to call myself an economist because it was so inadequate as a way of understanding the world. But I'm reclaiming that word, and I call myself a renegade economist, because economics means household management. And what could we need more today than planetary household management in the interest of all of its inhabitants? So I want to reclaim the idea of what economics is and what it's for. And I very much hope I'll come across your paths in that process. Thank you very much.
That was Kate Raworth, author of the 2017 book, Donut Economics. 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She spoke on December 10, 2016, at the conference by MedAct in London. She's teaching at Oxford University and the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. This is part 3 of a TUC Radio miniseries on renegade economics and how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. And you just heard a rebroadcast from October 2017. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org, and the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, the host, and with me is Phil Conlon. How you doing, Phil? Phil has got a program each Wednesday, Classical Underground, CIUT, at from 6 to 8. Or is it 9? 8, 6 to 8. They should give you 3 hours. It's classical music. Today we're going to talk to Peter Rosenthal about this upcoming event for Charles Roach, and they're naming a lane in Toronto for the great lawyer and advocate Charles Roach. And Charles Roach, by the way, was a supporter of CIUT and of the Taylor Report, and we're very proud of that. We used to have him on the show. And by the way, Charles brought a lot of great positive attention to Toronto because he was respected worldwide. He had friends on every continent who admired his legal skills, his political skills, and his conscience. And more than once I heard a lawyer say in my presence, thank God for Charles Roach. And so there's an event coming up. It's Today's Star has an article about Charles, and we'll be speaking to him shortly. Speaking to Peter Rosenthal shortly. Peter Rosenthal is at the firm of Roach and Schwartz. And we also, a little later, are going to have Michaela Leivas. And she will be telling us about her arrest in on the West Bank by Israeli authorities. And it's a dramatic story, also been covered in the Toronto Star. So, but I think Peter Rosenthal is with us. Are you there, Peter?
I am, more or less.
More or less. I'm sorry about that. I wasn't exactly sure you were there. But now I was very pleased to see this story in the Toronto, Greater Toronto Area section of the Toronto Star. And it says, Toronto to honor legendary civil rights activist. And I've sure got that right. Tell us, Peter, when is this going to be? Where is it going to be?
It's going to be this Wednesday, 2 days from now, at 7 o'clock, at the location of where the laneway honoring Charlie's is located. And where that is you go to St. Clair Avenue, and then one block north of there would be where the laneway is, and it runs between the streets of Rushton Road and Arlington Avenue. It doesn't have a name yet. It's going to have the name unveiled on Wednesday, Charlie Roach Lane. But if people come to St. Clair Avenue and go either to Rushton Road or Arlington Avenue and then walk a little bit north and look down the laneway, they should see a crowd gathering.
And, you will be there. Other, I think it's Councillor Mihevich will be there.
Joe Mihevich is organizing the thing, and he will speak, and so will several other speakers, including me. Briefly, everybody will speak briefly. People don't have to be concerned about sitting through a lot of speeches. It can be brief speeches, but honoring Charlie. And the people who are speaking are Joe Mihevich, Sunset Roach, Lennox, who's his daughter, Charlie's daughter, Lennox Farrell, an old comrade of Charlie's in Batsy and other endeavors. Denise Herrera Jackson, who's the CEO of the Festival Management Committee of Caravana now. And then Zenaina Akande, who people may remember as a member of the provincial legislature during Bob Rae's government and other things in the community. So there'll be just those talks and people are gathering to honor Charlie.
Peter, you would know that if it were Charles doing the event, of course, we would all have to sing.
Yeah, I hope it's a crowd that Charlie liked to be in front of. He liked to lead people in singing. He liked to lead people in chanting for justice at various situations and so on. So, you know, we can list a lot of Charlie's contributions and achievements, but for those of us who knew him, including you, certainly, Phil, and I hope some of your listeners, his personality was quite extraordinary. He was so up a person and so lively a person. There's a word, ebullient, which I don't use very often, but I think it should be attached to Charlie. And he was that way in fighting for justice, even under very difficult circumstances sometimes. And
He had a gift that, by the way, must have helped him, of course, as a practicing lawyer. He was unflappable.
Yeah, he was totally unflappable. He was totally cool, no matter what was going on around him, no matter what pressure. He did a lot of legal cases that were considered too radical by the judges to even consider. Sometimes they could be nasty to him and dumping on him for it. But he just remained cool and fought for what he believed in. But one case like that that I think of was when he started a case against the South African ambassador during the apartheid era, speaking against the University of Toronto. He argued that that was a violation of rights of people to be free from discrimination, since the ambassador then for South Africa was going around trying to convince people that apartheid was not so bad as they think it is, and we shouldn't divest from businesses that do business with apartheid and so on. And Charlie, in my view, correctly said, that man is an international criminal, according to the United Nations, and he shouldn't be allowed to speak publicly in Canada. So Charlie was very courageous to bring a case like that. Any lawyer would say, well, there's no way that can possibly win. And, of course, Charlie knew that, too. But he was willing to do it and to have the judge dump on him in order to make the political point that apartheid really was a criminal activity. Mm-hmm. And I think it did help to do that to some extent, even though the judge didn't recognize it at all.
Yeah. By the way, there was a dramatic episode at that time involving Lennox Farrell, someone said he threw the mace on the floor. There was some action. It was a harm to no one, but he got charged.
Yeah, what happened was there was a debate scheduled at Hart House at the University of Toronto, and the ambassador was there for that. He was the honorary visitor on the question of whether or not the West should divest from apartheid holding companies. And Lennox gave an impassioned speech and then took this mace, which is a heavy, serious object, and threw it in the direction of the South African ambassador. The warden of Hart House, who was sitting next to him, deflected it. But Lennox was charged with assault, but he was acquitted. The ambassador didn't want to appear as a witness.
He had enough troubles.
It would have been fun for a lawyer to examine the ambassador as to which is a worse crime, the apartheid regime that he represented or Lennox throwing a mace.
Yes. Charles took cases. It's hard to believe that actually such a person existed. By the way, we're speaking to Peter Rosenthal, and he is such a lawyer. But it is actually – many lawyers say there's this word pro bono. But Charles's office was a place where if you were in a desperate situation, had no friends, you could walk in the door and have a quality lawyer address your problems and represent you.
Absolutely. Charlie hardly ever turned anybody away, even though a lot of the cases that he represented people on were cases that had little chance of success and where he got no pay whatsoever. He did a huge amount of pro bono work for poorer people. And also, of course, his fights for social justice were all pro bono in the courts and in the streets.
Mm-hmm. I hope the speakers will mention that he was a serious Pan-Africanist, many ties in Africa,
and with
the black lawyers organizations in the United States, they stood up, for example, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Grenada, when everybody basically just ignored Grenada or treated it as though it was a humanitarian operation. And Charles and the Lawyers Guild. I forget the. Perhaps you can help me with the name of the individual. But they took up the case of Grenadians charged by the British and Americans.
Yeah, I don't recall the name. Was it? No, sorry, I don't recall the name. But one thing I want to mention before I forget to do it or before the interview is over is, we can't bring Charlie back, but we can see him on YouTube. And I really like to tell people to tune in on YouTube. Just put in Charles Roach in quotes into YouTube, and you'll get various things, including some speeches that he gave and some singing of various things, including his song that I really like about Free the Land of Bigotry and so on, various things. They're all from Charlie's later years, and he wasn't as vigorous when he made them as he had been, but still, even a remnant of Charles Roach is very impressive. And including towards you'll find on YouTube easily, towards the end of his life, a few months before he died, he was interviewed by CBC about his fight to avoid swearing an oath to the Queen in getting citizenship, a fight that he didn't succeed in, but that again had some important political overtones. Mm-hmm. But Charlie, it's really remarkable. You look at that interview and you see Charlie's weak looking, but he's still Charles Roach, very optimistic and sure of what he's doing and the wonderful human being that he was.
Yeah. Well, and he was one who, when he was born in Trinidad, was he not?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. He was subject of the monarchy and recognized as such. But then this complicated process, when he comes to Canada And because of the laws, the way they were, then he had to swear an oath. Here's somebody who was born a subject. And in Canada, then they say, but no, now you have to swear. I always thought that was something like double jeopardy.
Yeah, if that was, you mean for citizenship?
There
was,
yes.
But there was another issue, too, that Charlie was very lucky that, as you say, he was from Trinidad, and therefore his membership in the Law Society did not require him to swear allegiance to the Queen or to be a citizen at all. But then they started to change the law to say that lawyers in Ontario had to be citizens. And they notified Charlie that if he doesn't become a citizen by a certain time, he would not be able to continue to practice law. Mm-hmm. And just to show how principled Charlie was, he was figuring that's the end of it. This was not towards the end of his career. This was right in the highlight of his career.
I remember that.
But then, luckily, a lawyer in British Columbia named Andrews argued that it was unconstitutional to require that a lawyer be a citizen. And that case was won at the Supreme Court of Canada. So then the Law Society couldn't enforce making Charlie be a citizen. But that was really lucky for all of us, that otherwise Charlie's career in law would have been half what it was.
Yes. That's a great story. This is Peter Rosenthal. But I, by the way, I recall various him telling me of various judges and lawyers who came to him and said, Charles, do what I did. Cross your fingers behind your back.
Absolutely.
And,
that's right.
And they all said, just wink. And they want you to wink. And he said, no, I don't play that way.
Right. And he wouldn't do that even if it meant the loss of his career. And another thing that
Charles
he,
had, that, by this gift of his character, had a way of making everybody uncomfortable.
Right. But another thing that he gave up the possibility of because of his refusal to swear an oath to the Queen was becoming a judge. He was offered an appointment as a judge, and he said he's not going to take it because judges had to swear an oath to the Queen. He was a remarkably principled person.
And he would have been a great judge.
Yeah. Although I'm glad he wasn't a judge, though. Because
that's because you're a lawyer.
He would have been a great judge, but he wouldn't then have been able to do the kind of advocacy that he did.
Yes.
On the streets as well as in the courts, and combining those two together in a magnificent way.
Yeah, no, he had he really, given his political social commitments, he probably would not have done it. Would not have been able to practically do it. There have been a number of judges who have made some good history because of their qualities. We think of the Supreme Court justice in the U.S., but I have witnessed a couple of black judges here in Toronto who really were striking in court. Matter of fact, you and I were in the same courtroom once when I saw it. But anyway, Charles is a great figure. I like the fact they call him a legend because legends don't die. He's going to grow his reputation. The more people look into him, he could be studied. He could certainly should be emulated. And there will be more titles, more statues, things to come. Peter, tell us again where this is, when it is, and again, who will speak. I don't want to wear you out, but I may as well.
Okay.
It's the least I can do.
So the ceremony unveiling Charlie Roach Lane will take place this Wednesday, July 18, 7 p.m., just north of St. Clair Avenue West and in between Arlington Avenue and Rushton Road. And it'd be really nice if a lot of people came out for us to share our feelings about Charlie and recommit ourselves to trying to live up to his ideals.
Yeah. Well, Peter Rosenthal, thank you very much, and we will be there.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Okay. Bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll be talking about this further. We're certainly going to report on it when we come back next week as well. I think we'll have a little music, and we'll be back with Michelle Levy.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.